This is Audible.
Cress by Marissa Meyer. Book 3. The cat has caught the bird, and she will scratch out your eyes as well. You will never see your Rapunzel again. Chapter 31. The girl returned from her trip to the bar, setting a drink against Thorne's wrist so he would know where it was. He tilted his head toward her and lifted the cards.
What do you think?
Her braids brushed his shoulder.
I think,
she tugged at two cards in his hand.
These two.
Precisely the two I was thinking, he said, taking hold of the two cards. Our luck is changing right about now.
Two to the blind man, said the dealer, and Thorne heard the cards slapping down on the table.
He slid them up into his hand. The woman clicked her tongue.
That's not what we wanted,
she said, and he could hear the pout in her voice.
Ah, well, said Thorne, we can't win them all, or, apparently, any of them.
He waited until the bidding came around before folding. The woman leaned closer from behind him and nuzzled his neck.
The next hand will be yours.
Thorne grinned.
I am feeling lucky.
He listened as the bidding went twice around the table, and the winner claimed the pot with gestures and sevens. From the man's gruff voice, Thorne pictured a scraggly beard and an excessive belly. He'd drawn up detailed mental images of all the players at the table. The dealer was a tall and skinny man with a fine mustache. The lady beside him was elderly, and something kept jangling when she took her cards, so Thorne pictured an abundance of gaudy jewelry. He judged the man to his right to be scrawny with bad skin, but that was probably because he was winning the most. Of course, the woman who had draped herself over Thorne was viciously hot. And not at all lucky, it turned out. The dealer dealt out another hand, and Thorne raised his cards. Behind him, the girl let out a sad whistle.
So sorry, love,
she whispered. He pouted.
No hope? What a shame.
The bidding opened, moving around the table. Check. Bet. Raise. Thorne tapped his fingers against his cards and sighed. They were useless, judging from the woman's sad inflection. Naturally, he put his palm against his chips and slid the entire stack toward the center of the table, listening to the happy clatter of chips falling against one another. Not that he had a lot of them. All in, he said. The woman behind him was silent. The hand on his shoulder didn't even twitch. Nothing to acknowledge that he'd gone against her suggestion. Poker face, indeed.
You're a fool, said the scrawny player, but he folded.
Then the bearded man snorted with a sound that made Thorne's spine tingle, not from concern, but expectation. This was his man.
I'd raise if I thought you had anything left to bet, he said, followed by the clicking and clacking of chips.
The last two players folded. The dealer passed out cards to replace the throwaways, two to Thorne's opponent. He kept all his cards. If his lady disapproved, her statuesque hands hinted at nothing. They didn't bother to bid for the second round, knowing that Thorne was maxed out. Thorne fanned his cards out on the table. The dealer called them out, his finger thumping against his opponent's hand.
Doubles, then.
Royal triples win!
Thorne arched an eyebrow as the old lady with the jewelry let out a delighted giggle.
To the blind man!
I trust the royal triplets were mine.
Indeed, nice hand, said the dealer, pushing the chips in Thorne's direction.
He heard a chair crash to the ground.
You outdated piece of junk! You should have told him to fold that hand!
I did, said the girl behind Thorne, in an even tone that failed to acknowledge the insult. He chose to ignore my recommendation.
Thorne tipped back in his chair.
It's your own fault for teaching her the game so well.
If I'd won even a couple of hands, I wouldn't have been suspicious. But even my luck isn't this bad.
He twirled his fingers through the air, enjoying the explanation.
I just had to wait until there was a hand she claimed wasn't salvageable. And then I'd know I had a winner.
Beaming, he leaned forward and scooped the chips toward him, enjoying the way they filled up his arms. He heard a couple drop to the floor, but left them, unable to suffer the indignity of rummaging around with his fingers.
But, he said, beginning to stack up his earnings, chip by chip, having no idea what color or value any of them were,
I'm willing to make you a deal, if you aren't too sore a loser.
What deal? That was almost everything I had.
Your own fault, of course, for cheating. The man gargled something incoherent. But I'm nothing if not a businessman.
I'd like to buy your escort droid from you. He waved his fingers over the stacks of chips.
Would you say she's worth about this much?
The man spluttered.
You can't even see her!
Smirking, Thorn reached up and patted the hand that still rested on his shoulder.
She's very believable, he said, but I'm a man of keen observation, and what can I say?
She seems to be missing a pulse. He gestured at the chips again.
Fair trade?
He heard the screech of chair legs on tiles and the clumping of the man's boots as he rounded the table.
Uh-oh.
Thorn grabbed his cane from where he'd propped it against the table, just as he was pulled out of his seat by his shirt collar.
Now let's be gentlemen.
A crunching pain rattled through his skull, snapping his head back. He fell onto the floor, his cheekbone throbbing and the taste of iron on his tongue. Testing that his jaw worked, he pressed a hand against his face, knowing the punch would leave one heck of a mark.
That, he muttered through his muddled thoughts, was not politically correct.
A man roared, followed by more chairs screeching and furniture falling and something like dishes shattering and people yelling, and then there was a mess of limbs crawling and tumbling as a full-scale brawl broke out in the bar. Thorn curled up on himself, holding his cane above his head as a pathetic shield against the chaos, trying to make himself as small a target as he could. A wayward knee connected with his hip. A falling chair battered his forearms. Two hands snaked between his armpits, hauling him backward. Thorn kicked at the floor, allowing himself to be pulled out of the cluster of elbows and knees.
You all right? Said a man.
Thorn used his cane to level himself onto his feet and shoved his back against a wall, glad for its support and protection.
Yeah, thanks. If there's one thing I hate, it's a guy who goes berserk when he gets caught cheating. If you're going to do it, you have to be ready to take the fallout like a man.
Good policy, but I think he was more upset over you insulting his woman.
Thorn cringed and wiped some blood from his mouth. He was glad that at least all of his teeth felt secure.
Don't tell me she's not an escort droid. I could have sworn...
Oh, she's definitely an escort. Cute one, too. It's just a lot of men don't like admitting that their arm accessory is bought and, programmed.
Readjusting the bandana, Thorn shook his head.
Again, if you're going to do it, own it like a man. I mean, not to be rude, but do I know you?
Jamal, from the caravan.
Jamal, right. Thanks for the rescue.
My pleasure. You probably want to get some ice on that eye. Come on, let's get out of this mess before anyone else takes a dislike to you.
Chapter 32.
Ow!
Thorn moaned, placing a cooling pack against his throbbing cheekbone.
Why did he have to hit so hard?
You're lucky he didn't break your nose or knock out any teeth, said Jamal.
Thorn could hear him shuffling around, followed by glasses clinking together.
Well, that's true. I am rather attached to my nose.
There's a chair behind you.
Thorn tested the floor with his cane until it struck something hard, and eased himself onto the chair. He leaned the cane against the side and adjusted the pack on his cheekbone.
Here.
He
He held out his free hand and was glad when a cold, condensation-slicked glass was put into it. He sniffed first. The drink smelled faintly of lemons. Taking a sip, he found that it was cold and frothy, tart and delicious. The absence of sudden warmth suggested there was no alcohol.
"Tarm Hindi," said Jamal. "Tamarind juice, my favorite thing in the trading cities."
"Thank you." Thorn took a bigger gulp, his cheeks puckering from the sourness.
"Have you always been such a gambler?" Jamal asked.
"I guess you could say I enjoy a challenge." "No survival skills? Let's honeymoon in the desert. Can't see? Let's go play some cards. I would have won, too, if that guy hadn't gotten so touchy."
He thought he heard a chuckle, but then Jamal slurped at his drink.
"Were you there the whole time, watching that escort droid bleed me dry and not saying anything?"
"If a blind man wants to lose his head in a suicide card game, why should I stop him?"
Thorn relaxed against the back of the chair. "I guess I can respect that."
"I am curious why you didn't bring your girl with you. I'd have thought she'd been a valuable asset."
"I thought she could use the rest." Thorn adjusted the cooling pack on his face. "Plus, I don't think she's ever played royals before, and there are all those tricky rules to explain."
"And she probably wouldn't have been pleased about you wanting an escort droid?"
Thorn guffawed. "Oh, no, no. I didn't want the escort for me. I thought she'd make a nice gift." A silence followed, and he was sure he could picture the skepticism on Jamal's face, despite having no idea what Jamal looked like. "She was for this android. Spaceship. Friend of mine. It's complicated."
"It always is." Jamal clinched their glasses together. "I get it, though. You get your hands on an escort droid, all the while keeping everyone's attention away from the true prize upstairs. You do seem like the protective sort."
Thorne's instincts hummed at something in Jamal's tone.
"Well, I am a lucky man." "Yes, you are. A girl like that doesn't fall out of the sky every day."
Thorn kept his smile for a heartbeat, then downed the rest of the drink. His nose crinkled.
"Speaking of Mrs. Smith, I should get back to her. Promised to bring up some food and then got carried away. You know how it is."
"I wouldn't be in any hurry," said Jamal. "I saw her with Gina a couple hours ago. I think the ladies were going out for some refreshments."
The grin froze on Thorne's face, and now he knew for sure something wasn't right. Cress leave the hotel without telling him? Not likely. But why would Jamal lie about something like that?
"Ah, good," he said, hiding his uncertainty.
He set the empty glass down on the floor, tucking it beneath a chair so he wouldn't trip on it later.
"Cress could use some girly time. Did they happen to say where they were going?"
"No, but there are plenty of eateries on this street. Why, afraid she might run off without you?"
Thorn snorted, but it sounded forced even to him.
"Nah, this'll be good for her. Making friends. Eating stuff.
Exploring all that Earth has to offer?"
His expression must have been hilarious, because Jamal's laugh was loud and abrupt.
"Ha ha! I knew you wouldn't be surprised," he said. "Quende thought you didn't know she was lunar, but I figured you would. You strike me as the type of man who has a keen sense of value, especially when I saw you bargaining for that escort downstairs. Even blind, you do seem to have impeccable taste in female companionship."
"This is true," Thorn murmured, trying to recapture this conversation. "Sense of value. Impeccable taste? What was he talking about?"
"So, tell me how you came across her. It was a lunar satellite, I've got that much, but how did you get tangled up with her to begin with? Did you find her still in space, or down here in the desert?" "Must have been in space, I guess. There was that pod ship in the wreckage."
It's kind of a long story.
No matter. Not like I'm going to be up in space anytime soon, but then to crash. That couldn't have been part of your original plan.
Ice cubes crackled.
Tell me this, did you plan on bringing her to Africa the whole time, or are there more lucrative markets elsewhere in the Union?
I thought Africa. Thorne scratched his jaw. You said they've been gone for a couple of hours?
Give or take.
Chair legs squeaked across the floor.
So you must have known she was a shell when you found her. Couldn't find me trading in their kind otherwise. Don't care how much they're worth.
Thorne spread his free hand out on his knee and pressed his sudden panic into it. So they knew about the crashed satellite, and they knew Cress was a shell, and they seemed to be under the impression there was a market for that, and that Thorne wanted to, what, sell her? Trade her as stolen goods? Was there some strange black market demand for shells that he wasn't aware of?
Honestly, lunars terrify me, too, he said, trying to hide his ignorance. But not Cress. She's harmless.
Harmless, and not terrible to look at, either. So short, though.
There were footsteps, Jamal walking to the other side of the room, something being poured.
Another drink?
Thorne eased his tense knuckles off his own leg.
I'm fine, thank you.
Glass on wood.
Do you know where you're taking her yet, or are you still shopping around for a good price? I figured you were probably taking her to that old doctor in Farafra, but I have to tell you, I think Gina's interested. Could save you a lot of trouble.
Thorne smothered his discomfort and tried to imagine they weren't talking about Cress at all. They were business associates, discussing merchandise. He just had to figure out what Jamal knew that he clearly didn't. He slipped his finger beneath the blindfold, stretching the fabric away from his eyes. It was becoming too tight, and his cheek was throbbing more painfully than ever.
Interesting proposition, he said slowly. But why deal with a middleman when I can go straight to the end buyer?
Convenience. We'll take her off your hands, and you can be off on the next treasure hunt. Plus, we know this market better than anyone. We'll make sure she ends up in a nice place. If you care about that sort of thing.
He paused.
What were you hoping to get for her, anyway?
Merchandise. Business transactions. He attempted nonchalance, but his skin was crawling, and he found it difficult to set aside the memory of Cress's hand in his.
Make me an offer, he said.
There was a long hesitation.
I can't speak for Gina.
Then why are we having this conversation? Sounds to me like you're wasting my time.
Thorne reached for his cane.
She did give me a number, said Jamal.
Thorne paused, and after a long silence, Jamal continued.
But I'm not qualified to finalize anything.
We could at least find out if we're all playing the same game.
More slurping, followed by a long sigh.
We could offer you 20,000 for her.
This time, the shock was impossible to hide. Thorne felt like Jamal had just kicked him in the chest.
20,000 univs?
A sharp laugh rang off the walls.
Too low? You'll have to discuss it with Gina. But if you don't mind me asking, what were you hoping to get for her?
Thorne snapped his mouth shut. If their starting offer was 20,000 univs, what did they think she was really worth? He felt like a fool. What was this? Lunar trafficking? Some sort of weird fetishism? She was a girl. A living girl, smart and sweet and awkward and unusual, and she was worth far more than they could ever realize.
Don't be shy, Mr. Smith. You must have had some number in mind.
His thoughts started to clear, and it occurred to him that in many ways, he was just like these people, a businessman out to make a quick profit, who had been lucky enough to stumble onto a naive, overly trusting lunar shell. Except, he had a bad habit of just taking the things that he wanted. He dug his fingernails into his thighs. If she was worth that much,
Why wouldn't they simply take her?
Panic swept through him, like a lightning bolt arching through every limb. This wasn't a negotiation. This was a distraction. He'd been right before. Jamal was wasting his time, intentionally.
Thorn dropped the cooling pack and launched himself out of the chair, grabbing the cane. He was at the door in two strides, his hand fumbling for the knob, yanking open the door.
Chris!
He yelled, trying to remember how many doors they'd passed to get to Jamal's room. He was turned around, unable to remember which side of the hall his and Chris's room had been on to begin with.
Chris!
He stormed down the hall, pounding aimlessly on the walls and doors as he passed.
Can I help you, master?
He spun toward the female voice, his optimism thinking for a second that it was her, but no. The sound was too airy and fake, and Chris called him Captain. And Chris called him Captain. Who would call him Master?
Who's that?
My previous master called me Darling, said the voice. I'm your new escort droid. The house rules gave my former master a choice of returning your earnings to you or accepting your offered trade. He chose the trade, which means that I am now your personal property. You seem stressed. Would you like me to sing a relaxing song while I rub your shoulders?
Realizing that he was gripping his cane like a weapon, Thorn shook his head.
Roommate, where is it?
He heard a couple doors open down the hallway.
Chris?
What's all this noise about? Said a man.
Someone else started talking in that language Thorn didn't recognize.
Here's room 8, said the escort. Shall I knock?
Yes,
he followed the sound of her knocking and tested the knob. Locked, he cursed.
Chris!
Can we keep it down out here?
I'm afraid I'm programmed to avoid destruction of property, so I am unable to break down this door for you, master. Shall I go to the front desk and retrieve a key?
Thorn pounded at the door again.
She's not in there, said Jamal from down the hall.
That other language again, fast and annoyed.
Shall I translate, master?
Growling, Thorn marched back toward Jamal, his cane whipping against the corridor walls. He heard yelps of surprise as people ducked back into their rooms to avoid being hit.
Where is she? And don't try to tell me she's out enjoying a pleasant meal in town. And what will you do if I won't tell you? Propose a staring contest?
He despised that his alarm was showing, but every word raised his temperature, degree by boiling degree. It seemed like hours since he'd so flippantly said goodbye to Chris, when she was still in the bath, when her singing was still echoing in his ears. And he'd left her. He'd just left her. And why? To show off his gambling skills? To prove that he was still self-sufficient? To prove that he didn't need anyone? Not even her? Every moment that stretched on was agony. They could have taken her anywhere, done anything to her. She could be alone and frightened, wondering why he hadn't come for her, wondering why he'd abandoned her. He lashed out, his hand thwapping Jamal in the ear. Surprised, Jamal tried to duck away, but Thorn had already grabbed the front of his shirt and hauled him closer.
Where is she?
She's no longer your concern. If you were so attached, I guess you should have kept a better eye on her, rather than running off and flirting with the first steel-boned escort that passed by.
He placed a hand over Thorn's.
She saw that, you know. Saw that escort hanging all over you downstairs, looking pretty shaken up by the sight. Didn't even hesitate when Gina offered to take her away.
Thorn gritted his teeth as blood rushed to his face. He couldn't tell whether Jamal was lying, but the thought of Chris seeing him gambling with that escort droid and having no idea what he was really doing?
See, it's all just business, continued Jamal. You lost her? We took her. At least you got a pretty new toy out of the deal, so try not to feel too upset.
Grimacing, Thorn tightened his grip around the cane and brought it up as hard as he could, right between Jamal's legs. Jamal roared. Backing up, Thorn swung the cane toward his head. It cracked hard, but was quickly jerked out of his hand as Jamal let off a stream of curses. Thorn reached for the gun that had been nearly forgotten since he and Cress had left the satellite. He pulled it from his waistband and took aim. Screams from the other people in the hall bounced down the corridors, followed by the slamming of doors and the pounding of feet on the stairway.
"From this distance," he said, "I'm pretty sure I can hit you a few times. I wonder how many shots I can get in before I get a fatal one."
He lifted his head.
"Then I guess I'll just take your port screen, which probably has all your business contacts in it. You said something about a doctor in Farawada? I guess we'll try him first."
He released the safety.
"Wait, wait, you're right. They were taking her to Farafra, just a tiny oasis about 300 kilometers northeast of here. There's some doctor there who has a thing for lunar shells."
Thorn took a step back into the hallway, though he kept the gun up and ready.
"Escort droid, you still there?"
"Yes, master. Can I be of assistance?"
"Get me the coordinates of a town called Farafra, and the fastest way to get there." "You're an idiot to go after her," said Jamal. "She'll already be sold, and that old man isn't going to pay for her twice. You should just cut your losses and move on. She's just a lunar shell. She isn't worth it."
"If you honestly believe that," said Thorn, stowing the gun again, "then you really don't recognize true value when you see it."
Chapter 33. Cress crouched in the corner of the van, gripping her knees against her chest. She was trembling, despite the sweltering heat. She was thirsty and hungry, and her shins were bruised where they'd collided with the van's ledge. Though she'd pulled down the bolts of fabric to sit on, the constant jerking of the truck on the uneven ground made her backside ache. The night was so dark she couldn't see her hand in front of her face, but sleep wouldn't come. Her thoughts were too erratic as she tried to discern what these people wanted with her. She'd played the moments before her capture over in her head 100 times, and Gina's expression had definitely lit up when Cress had confirmed Gina's suspicions. She was a shell. A worthless shell. Why had Gina sensed value in that? She racked her brain, but nothing made sense. She tried her best to remain calm, tried to be optimistic, tried to tell herself that Thorn would come for her. But doubts kept crowding out the hope. He couldn't see. He didn't know where she'd gone. He probably didn't even know she was missing yet. And when he found out? What if he thought she'd abandoned him? What if he didn't care? She couldn't forget the image of Thorn sitting at that card table with some strange girl draped over him. He hadn't been thinking about Cress then. Perhaps Thorn wouldn't come for her. Perhaps she'd been wrong about him all this time. Perhaps he wasn't a hero at all, but just a selfish, arrogant, womanizing... She sobbed, her head cluttered with too much fear and anger and jealousy and horror and confusion, all of it writhing and squirming in her thoughts until she couldn't keep her frustrated screams bottled up any longer. She wailed, scrunching her hair in her fists until her scalp burned. But her screams died out fast, replaced with clenched teeth as she attempted to calm herself again. She rubbed her fingers around her wrists as if she had long strands of hair to wrap around them. She swallowed hard in an attempt to gulp down the rising panic, to keep herself from hyperventilating. Thorn would come for her. He was a hero. She was a damsel. That's how the stories went. That's how they always went. With a groan, she settled into her corner and started to cry again. Cried until no more tears would come. Suddenly, she jolted awake. There was salt dried on her cheeks, and her back ached from being hunched over. Her butt and sides were bruised from the bumping of the van, which, she realized, had come to a stop. She was instantly alert, the grogginess shaken off by a new wave of fear. There was a hint of light coming through the cracks around the doors, which meant they'd driven through the night. A door slammed and she could make out Gina's chatter, no longer friendly and comforting. The van shook as the driver got out.
"Making good time," Cress heard a man say. "Someone want to help me back here?"
Another man laughed.
Can't take the little waif yourself.
Gina's voice cut through their boasting.
Try not to bruise her. I want top payment this time, and you know how he negotiates, nitpicking every little thing.
Cress gulped as the boots came closer. She steeled herself. She would lunge. She would fight. She would be ferocious. Bite and scratch and kick if she had to. She would take him by surprise. And then she would run. Fast as a cheetah. Graceful as a gazelle. It was still early. The sand would be cool on her bare feet. Her blisters were almost healed, and while her legs still ached horribly, she could ignore them. Hopefully they would deem her not worth coming after. Or maybe they would shoot her. She gulped down the thought. She had to take the risk. The lock clanked. She took in a deep breath, waited for the door to open, and pounced. A guttural scream was ripped out of her, all her anger and vulnerability swelling up and unleashing in that one vicious moment as her clawed fingers scrabbled for his eyes. The man caught her. Two hands snapped around her pale wrists. Her momentum kept her careening outside the truck, and she would have tumbled to the sand if he hadn't held her half suspended. Her war cry was abruptly cut off. The man started to laugh. Laughing at her pathetic attempts to overpower him.
She is a tiger, I'll give you that, he said to the man who had teased him.
He twisted Cress around so he could hold both of her wrists in one firm grip. Her body dangled from his hold as he began marching her away from the van and into the dunes.
Let me go,
she shrieked, kicking back at him, but he was undeterred by her flailing.
Where are you taking me? Let me go!
Calm down, little girl. I'm not going to hurt you. Wouldn't be worth it.
He snorted and dropped her down the other side of the dune. She stumbled and rolled a couple of times in the sand before bolting into a crouch. She swiped hair and sand from her face. By the time she looked up at the man, he had a gun pinned on her. Her heart sputtered.
Try to run, I shoot. And I don't mean to kill. But you're smarter than that, aren't you? You've got nowhere to go anyway, right?
Cress gulped. She could still hear the voices on the other side of the dune. She hadn't been able to tell how many caravanners were still along in the group.
What do you want from me?
I suspect you have business to tend to.
Standing, she stumbled a bit down the hill, the sand unstable beneath her. The man didn't flinch. He jerked the barrel of the gun toward her feet.
Go on. It'll be another few hours before we stop, so better get it out of the way now. Don't want you losing your water in the back of that nice van. We wouldn't get our security deposit back, and Gina hates that.
Her lower lip trembled, and she cast another glance around the desert, the wide openness of this barren landscape. She shook her head.
No, I can't. Not with you.
Ugh, I won't watch.
To prove his point, he spun around and scratched behind his ear with the gun.
Just make it quick.
She spotted another man over the dune, faced away from her, and suspected he was relieving himself. Cress turned away, ashamed and embarrassed. She wanted to cry, wanted to beg the man to let her be, to just leave her here. But she knew it wouldn't work. And she didn't want to beg this man for anything. Thorn would come for her, she thought, as she stumbled to the base of the dune in search of what privacy she could find. Thorn had to come for her. Chapter 34 Fatine Jia? The girl spun around, her long black braid swinging against her lab coat.
Your Majesty!
A ghost smile flickered over Kai's face.
Do you have a moment to assist us with something?
Of course.
Fatine tucked a port screen into her coat pocket. Kai moved toward the wall of the white corridor, allowing room for researchers and technicians to pass by.
We need access to some patient records. I realize they're probably confidential, but...
Kai trailed off. There was no but, only a vague hope and a fair amount of confidence that his title was the only credential he needed. But Fatine's gaze darkened, as they flickered between him and Torin.
Patient records?
A few weeks ago, said Kai, I came to check on Dr. Erlon's progress, and Lynn Cinder was here, the lunar cyborg from...
I know who Lynn Cinder is,
she said, her hardness fading as quickly as it had come.
Right, of course, he cleared his throat. Well, at the time, the doctor told me she was there fixing a medroid. But I was thinking about it, and I thought, maybe she had actually been...
A draft subject?
Yes.
Fatine shrugged.
Actually, she was a volunteer. Come on, there should be a vacant lab you can use. I'm happy to pull up Lynn Cinder's records for you.
He and Torin followed her, Kai wondering whether she would have been as accommodating had it been any other patient. Since the arrest, Lynn Cinder had become a matter of public concern, and therefore her private records weren't so private anymore.
She was a volunteer? Really?
Yes, I was here the day she was brought in. They'd had to override her system to get her in here. I guess she put up quite a fight when they came for her.
Kai frowned. Why would a volunteer put up a fight?
I'm using volunteer in the official sense. I believe her legal guardian recommended her for the testing.
She swiped her wrist over an ID scanner, then ushered them into Lab 6D.
The room smelled of bleach and peroxide, and every surface glistened to a perfect shine. A counter along the far wall was set before a window overlooking a quarantine room. Kai grimaced, reminded of his father's last days spent in a room not entirely unlike that one. Although his had been equipped with blankets and pillows, his favorite music, a tranquil water fountain. The patients who came to these labs would not have received the same luxuries.
Fatine paced to the adjoining wall.
Screen on, she said, tapping something into her port screen. I do believe these records were part of the investigation following her jailbreak, Your Majesty. Do you think the detectives have missed something?
He threaded his fingers through his hair.
No, I'm just trying to answer some of my own questions.
The lab's login screen faded, replaced with a patient profile. Her profile. Lynn Cinder, licensed mechanic, ID number 00979173305, born 29 November 109 TE, resident of New Beijing, Eastern Commonwealth, ward of Lynn Audrey, cyborg ratio 36.28%.
Is there something specific you're looking for? Fatine asked, sliding her fingers along the screen so that the profile trekked down into blood type A, allergies none, and medications unknown. Then, the plague test. Kai stepped closer.
What's this?
The doctor's notes from when we injected her with the Letamosis microbe solution. How much we gave her, and, subsequently, how long it took her body to rid itself of the disease. At the end of the study, the simple words. Conclusion, Letamosis immunity confirmed.
Immunity? Said Torin, coming to stand beside them. Did we know about this?
Perhaps the detectives didn't think it was relevant to their search, but it's common knowledge here in the labs. Many of us have theorized it's a result of her lunar immune system. There's a long-held theory that Letamosis was brought here by migrating lunars, who are unaffected carriers of the disease.
Kai fidgeted with his shirt's collar. How many lunars would have had to come to Earth to create such a widespread epidemic?
If this theory was correct, they could have a lot more fugitives on the planet than he'd realized.
He groaned at the thought. The mere idea of having to deal with more lunars made him want to beat his head against a wall.
What does this mean?
Asked Torin, pointing to a box at the bottom of the profile.
Additional notes. Finally. I've found her.
The words gave Kai a chill, but he wasn't sure why.
Fatine shook her head. Nobody knows. Dr. Erlon entered it, but he gave no indication of what it meant. Probably it refers to her immunity. He finally found what he was looking for when she was brought in. Her tone became bitter. Though lots of good that did us when both of them decided to skip town.
Fatine's port pinged, and she glanced down on it.
I'm so sorry, Your Majesty. It seems today's draft subject has just arrived.
Kai ripped his attention away from those haunting words.
The draft is still in effect?
Of course,
Fatine said with a smile, and Kai realized what a stupid question it was. Here he was, the Emperor, and he had no idea what was going on in his own country, in his own research labs. With Dr. Erland gone, I just thought maybe it was over, he explained.
Dr. Erland may be a traitor, but there are still a lot of people here who believe in what we're doing. We won't quit until we've found a cure.
You're doing great work here, said Torin. The Crown appreciates all these advances that have been made already in these labs.
Fatine tucked her port back into her pocket.
We've all lost someone to this disease.
Kai's tongue grew heavy.
Fatine Jaer, did Dr. Erland ever inform you that Queen Levana had developed an antidote?
She blinked at him, confused.
Queen Levana?
He glanced at Cinder's chart, evidence of her immunity, and her lunar biology.
A part of our marriage alliance will include the manufacturing and distribution of this antidote.
Torn's voice was terse.
Though His Majesty will require that this information remain confidential until the Crown issues an official statement.
I see, she said slowly, still watching Kai. That would change everything.
It would.
Her calm pinged again. Shaking off her surprise, Fatine bowed to Kai.
I'm sorry, Your Majesty. If you would excuse me?
Of course.
Torin gestured toward the hall.
Thank you for your assistance.
My pleasure. Take all the time you need.
She bowed and left the lab with her braid swinging. The moment the door closed behind her, Torin scowled at the Emperor.
What reason did you have for giving her that information? Until the antidote is confirmed as both effective, harmless, and capable of reproduction, it's foolhardy to spread such rumors.
I know, said Kai. It just seemed like she should know. She mentioned the draft, and I realize how many people are still dying. Not just being killed by the disease, but being killed by us while we try to find a cure. And all the while, an antidote is out there, just out of...
His eyes widened. Immunity confirmed.
Stars! The Queen's antidote!
Pardon me?
Cinder was here the day I gave the antidote to Dr. Erland. He must have given it to her, and she went straight to the quarantines, knowing that she was immune. She was taking it to her sister, trying to save her. But she must have been too late, so she gave the antidote to that little boy instead, Chang Sunto.
He shook his head, surprised at how light this realization made him. He found himself smiling.
Her guardian is wrong. Cinder didn't take her sister's ID chip because she was jealous or she wanted to steal her identity or anything like that. She took it because she loved her.
And you believe that cutting out a loved one's ID chip is a healthy response?
Maybe she'd somehow figured out that the androids were harvesting them and giving them to lunars. Or maybe she was just in shock. But I don't think it was out of malice.
He collapsed against the wall, feeling as if he'd just discovered an important clue in the mystery that was Lin Cinder.
We should let Fatine Jaer and the others know that Chang Sunto wasn't a miraculous recovery. This confirms that the Queen's antidote is real, and maybe they can use that information in their research. It might be useful, or...
His elbow bumped the net screen, and an image shimmered beside him. Kai jumped away as the holograph projected out of the screen, rotating within arm's reach. It was a girl, life-size, her different layers flickering and folding into one another. Skin and scar tissues melded with a steel hand and leg. Wires merged with her nervous system. Blue blood pumped through silicone heart chambers. All the inorganic tissue had a faint glow as the holograph pinpointed what wasn't natural about her, so that even the untrained eye could comprehend. Cyborg. Kai backed away, feeling disoriented as he gaped at her. Even her eyes had that faint glow to them, along with the optic nerves that stretched to the back of her brain, where there was a metal plate fitted with ports and cables and wires, and an access hatch that opened in the back of her skull. He remembered her guardian saying that Cinder was unable to cry. But he'd never thought, never expected this. Her eyes? Her brain? He looked away and dragged a palm down his face. This was an invasion. A terrible kind of voyeurism. And the sudden guilt made him wish he could erase the sight from his mind forever. Screen off. A silence engulfed them, and he wondered if Torin felt the same guilt he did, or if he'd even been caught by the same morbid curiosity.
Are you all right, Your Majesty?
Fine, he gulped. We knew she was cyborg. None of this should be a surprise. I just hadn't expected it to be so much. Torn slid his hands into his pocket.
I'm sorry. I know I haven't always been fair where Lynn Cinder was concerned. From the moment I saw you talking to her at the ball, I've been worried she would be an unnecessary distraction to you. And you were already dealing with so much. But it's obvious that you did have legitimate feelings for her, and I'm sorry for all that's happened since then.
Kai shrugged uncomfortably. The problem with that is that even I don't know if I had legitimate feelings for her, or if it was always just a trick.
Your Majesty, the Lunar Gift has limitations. If Lynn Cinder had been forcing these feelings onto you, then you wouldn't still be feeling them.
Starting, Kai met Torin's gaze. I don't, he gulped, heat climbing up his neck.
It's that obvious? Well, as Queen Levana likes to point out, you are still young and not yet adept at disguising your emotions like the rest of us.
Torin smiled, a teasing look that crinkled the corners of his eyes.
To be frank, I feel that it is one of your better qualities.
Kai rolled his eyes. Ironically, I think that might be why I liked Cinder so much in the first place.
That she couldn't disguise her emotions?
That she didn't try. At least, that's how it seemed. Kai leaned back against the exam table, feeling the sterile paper crinkle beneath his fingers. Sometimes it just seems like everyone around me is pretending. The Lunars are the worst. Levana and her entourage. Everything about them is so fake. I mean, I'm engaged to Levana, and I still don't even know what she really looks like. But it isn't just them. It's the other union leaders, even my own cabinet members. Everyone is trying to impress everyone else, trying to make themselves out to be smarter or more confident than they actually are. He raked his hand through his hair. And then there was Cinder. This completely normal girl working this completely mundane job. She was always covered in dirt or grease, and she was so brilliant when she was fixing things. And she joked about stuff with me, like she was talking to a normal guy, not a prince. Everything about her seemed so genuine. At least, that's what I'd thought. But then, it turned out she was just like everyone else. Torin paced to the window overlooking the quarantine room.
And yet, you're still trying to find reasons to believe in her.
It was true. This whole escapade had been sparked by Torin's accusations that Kai didn't know anything about Cinder. That even now, knowing that she was cyborg, knowing that she was lunar, he still wanted to believe that not everything about her had been based on some complicated deception. And in coming here, he had learned some things. He'd learned that she was immune to letimosis, that maybe all Lunars were. He'd learned that those brown eyes that kept infiltrating his dreams had been man-made, or had at least been tampered with. He'd learned that her guardian had sold her body off for testing, and that she hadn't hated her sister, and that the cyborg draft was still in effect. Still ordering cyborgs to the labs every day. still sacrificing them in order to find an antidote that Queen Levana already had.
Why cyborgs? He murmured. Why do we only use cyborgs for the draft?
Torrin sighed.
All due respect, Your Majesty. Do you really think this is the best issue to be concerning yourself with right now? With the wedding, the alliance, the war?
Yes, I do. It's a valid question. How did our society decide that their lives are worth less? I'm responsible for everything that happens in this government. Everything. And when something affects the citizens like this...
The thought struck him like a bullet. They weren't citizens.
Or they were, but it was more complicated than that. Had been since the Cyborg Protection Act had been instated by his grandfather decades ago. The act came after a series of devastating cyborg crimes had caused widespread hatred and led to catastrophic riots in every major city in the Commonwealth. The protest may have been prompted by the violent spree, but they were a result of generations of growing disdain. For years, people had been complaining about the rising population of cyborgs, many of whom received their surgeries at the hands of taxpayers. Cyborgs were too smart, people had complained. They were cheating the average man out of his wages. Cyborgs were too skilled. They were taking jobs away from hard-working average citizens. Cyborgs were too strong. They shouldn't be allowed to compete in sporting events with regular people. It gave them an unfair advantage. And then, one small group of cyborgs had gone on a spree of violence and theft and destruction, demonstrating just how dangerous they could be. If doctors and scientists were going to continue to perform these operations, people argued, there needed to be restrictions placed on their kind. They needed to be controlled. Kai had studied it all when he was 14 years old. He had agreed with the laws. He'd been convinced, as his grandfather before him had been, that they were so obviously right. Cyborgs required special laws and provisions for the safety of everyone. Didn't they? Until this moment, he didn't think he'd given the question a second thought. Realizing that he'd been staring at an empty lab table with his knuckles pressed against his forehead, he turned around and stood a little straighter. Torrin was watching him with that ever-present wise expression that so often drove him crazy, waiting patiently for Kai to form his thoughts.
Is it possible? The laws are wrong? He said, peculiarly nervous, like he was speaking blasphemy against his family and his country's age-old traditions.
About cyborgs?
Torrin peered at him for a long time, giving no hint to what he thought of Kai's question, until finally he sighed.
The Cyborg Protection Act was written up with good intentions. The people saw a need to control the growing cyborg population, and the violence has never again reached the level it was at that time.
Kai's shoulders sloped. Torrin was probably right. His grandfather had probably been right, and yet...
And yet, said Torrin, I believe it is the mark of a great leader to question the decisions that came before him. Perhaps, once we've solved some of our more immediate problems, we can readdress this.
More immediate problems.
I don't disagree with you, Torrin, but there's a draft subject in this very research wing at this very moment. I'm sure this seems like an immediate problem to him, or her.
Your Majesty, you cannot solve every problem in a week. You need to give yourself time.
You agree that it's a problem, then?
Torrin frowned. Thousands of citizens are dying from this disease. Would you discontinue the draft and the research opportunities it provides on the basis that the Lunars are going to solve this for us?
No, of course not. But using cyborgs and only cyborgs? It seems wrong, doesn't it?
Because of Lynn Cinder?
No, because of everyone. Because whatever science has made them, they were once human too. And I can't believe that they're all monsters. Whose idea was the draft anyway? Where did it come from? Torn glanced toward the net screen, looking strangely conflicted.
If I recall, it was Dmitri Erlan's idea. We had many meetings about it. Your father wasn't sure at first, but Dr. Erlan convinced us that it was for the best of the Commonwealth.
Cyborgs are easy to register, easy to track, and with their legal restrictions, easy to take advantage of.
No, Your Majesty.
Easy to convince both them and the people that they are the best candidates for the testing.
Because they aren't human?
He could see that Torin was growing frustrated.
Because their bodies have already been aided by science. Because now it's their turn to give back, for the good of everyone.
They should have a choice.
They had a choice when they accepted the surgical alterations. Everyone is well aware what the laws are regarding cyborg rights.
Kai thrust his finger toward the blackened net screen.
Cinder became a cyborg when she was 11, after a freak hover accident. You think an 11-year-old has a choice about anything?
Her parents, Torin paused.
According to the file, Cinder's parents had died in that same hover accident. They didn't know who had approved her cyborg surgery. Torin set his mouth into a straight, displeased line.
She is an unusual circumstance.
Maybe so, but it still doesn't feel right.
Kai paced to the quarantine window, rubbing a knot in his neck.
I'm putting an end to it. Today.
Are you sure this is the message you want to send to the people? That we're giving up on an antidote?
We're not giving up. I'm not giving up. But we can't force people into this. We'll raise the grant money for volunteers. We'll increase our awareness programs, encourage people to volunteer themselves if they choose to. But as of now, the draft is over.
Chapter 35. Cinder stumbled up the ship's ramp, pulling her shirt away from her hips in an effort to get some airflow against her skin. The desert heat was dry compared with the suffocating humidity of New Beijing, but it was also relentless. Then, there was the sand. That annoying, hateful sand. She had spent what seemed like hours trying to clean it out of her cybernetic joints, discovering more nooks and crannies in her hand than she'd known existed.
Aiko, close ramp, she said, sinking onto a crate.
She was exhausted. All her time was spent worrying over Wolf and trying to be gracious to the townfolk who had brought her so many gifts of sugar dates and sweet rolls and spiced curries that she wasn't sure if they were trying to thank her or fatten her up for a feast. On top of that were the constant arguments with Dr. Erland. He wanted her to focus on finding a way to get onto Luna without being captured. And while she had conceded that that would have to happen eventually, she was still set on putting a stop to the royal wedding first. After all, what did it matter if she dethroned Lavanna on Luna after she was crowned Empress of the Commonwealth? There had to be a way to do both. But the royal wedding was only a week away, and Aiko's clock seemed to tick faster with every hour.
How is he? Asked Aiko.
Poor Aiko, who was stuck alone inside the spaceship's system for hours at a time while Cinder was at the hotel. The doctor started weaning him off the sedatives this morning, said Cinder. He's afraid that if Wolf wakes up again when no one is there, he'll have a mental breakdown and re-injure himself. But I told him we can't keep him unconscious forever. The ship sighed around her, oxygen hissing out of the life support system. Reaching down, Cinder pulled off her boots and dumped the sand out onto the metal floor. Has there been any news?
Yes, two interesting developments, actually.
The net screen on the wall brightened. On one side was a static order form with confidential emblazoned across the top. Despite the spark of curiosity it caused, Cinder's attention was drawn immediately to the other article and a picture of Kai. Emperor demands immediate discontinuation of cyborg draft. Heart-skipping, Cinder hopped off the crate to get a better look. The very mention of the draft brought memories flooding back to her.
being taken by androids, waking up in a sterile quarantine room, strapped to a table, having a ratio detector forced into her head and a needle plunged into her vein. The article opened with a video of Kai at a press conference, standing behind a podium. Play video. This policy change in no way indicates a sense of hopelessness, Kai was saying on the screen. We are not giving up on finding a cure for ledimosis. Please be aware that our team has made stunning progress in the past months, and I am confident that we are on the verge of a breakthrough. I want all those who are suffering from this sickness or have loved ones who are battling it right now to know that this is not a sign of defeat. We will never give up until ledimosis has been eradicated from our society. He paused, his silence punctuated by flashes that bounced off the Commonwealth's flag behind him. However, it recently came to my attention that the use of the cyborg draft to further our research was an antiquated practice that was neither necessary nor justifiable. We are a society that values human life. All human life. The purpose of our research facilities is to stanch the loss of that life as quickly and humanely as possible. The draft went against that value and, I believe, belittled all that we have accomplished in the 126 years since our country was formed. Our country was built on a foundation of equality and togetherness, not prejudice and hatred. Cinder watched him with a weakness in her limbs. She yearned to reach into the screen and wrap her arms around him and say thank you. Thank you. But thousands of miles away, she found herself hugging herself instead. I anticipate the criticism and backlash that this decision will cause, Kai continued. I am fully aware that ledimosis is a problem that affects every one of us, and that my decision to end the cyborg draft without first conferencing with my cabinet and your representatives is both unexpected and unconventional. But I could not stand by while our citizens were being forced to sacrifice their lives under a mistaken belief that their lives are less valuable than those of their peers. The ledimosis research team will be developing new strategies for the continuation of their research, and we at the palace are optimistic that this change will not hinder our ongoing search for an antidote. We will continue accepting test subjects on a volunteer basis. There is a comm link below for anyone wanting more information on the volunteer process. Thank you. I will not be taking questions today. As Kai left the stage and was replaced with the press secretary, already trying to calm a boisterous crowd, Cinder sank to the floor. She could hardly believe what she'd heard. Kai's speech was not only about ledimosis and research and medical procedures. His speech had been about equality, rights, moving past the hatred. With one speech, not 3 minutes spent behind the podium, Kai had begun to unravel decades of cyborg prejudice. Had he done it for her? She grimaced, wondering whether it was absurdly self-absorbed for her to even think that. After all, this declaration would save countless cyborg lives. It would set a new standard for cyborg rights and treatment. It wouldn't solve everything, of course. There was still the Cyborg Protection Act that claimed cyborgs as property of their guardians and limited their freedoms. But it was something. It was a start. And the question came back again and again. Had he done it for her?
I know, said Aiko with a dreaminess in her tone, though Cinder hadn't said anything. He's fantastic.
When she could focus her thoughts enough to skim through the rest of the article, Cinder saw that Kai was right. The hostility had already begun. This particular journalist had written a scathing criticism piece, defending the cyborg draft and accusing Kai of unjust preferential treatment. Though he didn't mention Cinder directly, it would only be a matter of time before someone did. Kai had invited a cyborg to the annual ball,
and they would use it against him. He would be attacked for this decision, viciously. But he had done it anyway.
Cinder, said Aiko, have you moved on to the escort droids yet?
She blinked. I'm sorry, what? The screen changed, pulling the first document to the forefront. Cinder shook her head to clear it. She'd forgotten all about the second item that Aiko had wanted to tell her about. The order form labeled confidential. Oh, right. She pulled herself to her feet. She would think about Kai and his decision later. After she had found a way to keep him from marrying Lavanna. What is this?
It's an order placed by the palace 2 days ago. I stumbled on it by accident when I was trying to figure out their florist order. Turns out the queen is having her bouquet made of lilies and hosta leaves. Boring! I would have gone with orchids myself.
You found a confidential order form from the palace itself?
Yes, I did. Thank you for noticing. I'm turning into quite the savvy hacker. Not that I have anything better to do.
Cinder scanned the form. It was a rental agreement placed with the world's largest escort droid manufacturer, which was headquartered just outside New Beijing. The palace wanted 60 escorts for the day of the wedding, but only those from the reality line, which included models with average eye colors and varying body types. The idea was that such imperfections, as the company called them, gave a more lifelike experience with your escort. It took her about 4 seconds to grasp the order's purpose.
They're going to use them as staff during the wedding, she said.
Because lunars can't manipulate them.
Smart. That's what I thought, too, said Aiko. The agreement states that they'll be delivered to the florist and catering companies the morning of the wedding, and that they'll be smuggled into the palace along with the human staff. Well, it doesn't use the word smuggle.
It didn't exactly make Cinder feel better about the wedding, but she was glad that the palace was taking some precautions against their lunar guests. Then, as she read through the order form and the delivery instructions, she gasped.
What is it? Said Aiko.
I just had an idea. She took a step back, running it through in her head. The idea was too raw and messy for her to be certain, but on the surface...
Aiko! That's it!
That's how we're going to get onto Luna!
The lights flickered.
I don't compute.
What if we hit on a ship that was already going to Luna? We could be smuggled in, just like these androids are being sneaked into the palace.
Except all the ships that go to Luna are lunar ships. How will you get aboard one of them?
Right now, they're all lunar ships. But I might know how we can change that. The feeds on the net screen shifted, bringing the ticking clock front and center.
Does it still involve stopping the wedding?
Yes, sort of. Cinder held up a finger. If we can delay the wedding and persuade Queen Lavanna to host the ceremony on Luna instead of Earth, then all the Earthen guests will have to go there, just like all those lunar aristocrats are coming here.
And then you'll be on one of their ships?
If we can make it work. She started to pace back and forth through the cargo bay, her thoughts burning with the start of a new plan. But I have to get Kai to trust me first. If he can persuade Lavanna to change the location... Chewing the inside of her cheek, Cinder glanced at the video of the press conference, the headline confirming that he really had ended the draft.
We still need to get into the palace, but no more big distractions or hijacking the media. We need to be subtle. Sneaky. Oh, you should pose as a guest! Then you would have an excuse to buy a fancy dress, too!
Cinder tried to protest, but hesitated. The idea had potential, if she could keep her glamour up long enough so that no one would recognize her. I would have to be wary of those escorts. Plus, we would need invitations.
I'm on it!
The order form disappeared, replaced with a streaming list of names.
A gossip newsfeed posted a list of all the guests a few days ago. Did you know they're sending actual paper invitations?
very classy.
Sounds wasteful, Cinder murmured.
Maybe so, said Aiko, but also easy to steal. How many do we need? 2, 3?
Cinder ticked her fingers. One for her, one for Wolf. Hopefully. If not, would it be better for her to go alone, or to bring the doctor, or even Jason? Lavanna and her entourage would recognize any one of them, and she didn't trust that they were capable of creating strong enough glamours for themselves. She would just have to hope that Wolf was better by then. 2, she said. Hopefully. Names and titles dragged down the screen. Diplomats and political representatives, celebrities and media commentators, entrepreneurs and the very, very rich. She couldn't help thinking that it sounded like a really dull party. Then, Aiko shrieked. An ear-splitting, metal-on-metal, overheated processor and wires-on-fire shriek. Cinder covered her ears. What? What's wrong? The list of names stopped, and Aiko highlighted a line. Lin Audrey and daughter Lin Pearl of New Beijing, EC, Earth. Gaping, Cinder pulled her hands away from her ears. Lin Audrey? And Pearl? She heard footsteps thumping from the crew quarters, and Jason appeared in the cargo bay, eyes wide.
What happened? Why is the ship screaming?
Nothing. Everything's fine, Cinder stammered.
No, everything is not fine, said Aiko. How can they be invited? I've never seen a bigger injustice in all my programmed life, and believe me, I have seen some big injustices.
Jason raised an eyebrow at Cinder. We just learned that my former guardian received an invitation to the wedding. She opened the tab beside her stepmother's name, thinking maybe it was a mistake. But of course not. Lin Audrey had been awarded 80,000 univs and an official invitation to the royal wedding as an act of gratitude for her assistance in the ongoing manhunt for her adopted and estranged daughter, Lin Cinder.
Because she sold me out, she said, sneering. Figures.
See? Injustice! Here we are, risking our lives to rescue Kai and this whole planet, and Audrey and Pearl get to go to the royal wedding? I'm disgusted. I hope they spill soy sauce on their fancy dresses.
Jason's concern turned fast to annoyance.
Your ship has some messed up priorities, you know that?
Aiko. My name is Aiko. If you don't stop calling me the ship, I am going to make sure you never have hot water during your showers again. Do you understand me?
Yeah. Hold that thought while I go disable the speaker system.
What? You can't mute me! Cinder!
Cinder held up her hands.
Nobody is disabling anything.
She glared at Jason, but his only response was a one-shouldered shrug. She rolled her eyes.
Ugh, you're both giving me a headache. And I'm trying to think.
Jason leaned against the wall, crossing his arms over his chest.
Did you know that I was there that night at the Commonwealth Ball?
Her eyelid twitched. How could I forget? She didn't think of it often, not since he'd joined their side. But sometimes, when she looked at him, she couldn't help remembering how he had been the one to grab and hold her while Lavanna taunted Kai, trying to bargain with Cinder's life.
Flattered. Thing is, you were pretty memorable that night, too. What with being publicly humiliated, almost shot in the head, and ultimately arrested. So it strikes me as odd that you would seem to be doing everything you can to figure out a way to go back there.
She threw her hands in the air.
And you can't think of a single reason why I would want to be at that wedding?
One more fling with your toy before he becomes Lavanna's property? You were swooning over him an awful lot at the...
Cinder punched him. Jason stumbled against the wall, already chuckling as his hand came up to his cheekbone.
Did I hit a nerve, or was it a wire that time? You have plenty of both, right?
He's not a toy, and he's not her property, she said. Insult either of us again, and next time, I'll hit you with the metal fist. You tell him, Cinder!
Aiko cheered. Jason lowered his hand,
revealing a red mark.
Why do you care? This wedding isn't your problem.
Of course it's my problem. In case you haven't noticed, your queen is a tyrant. Maybe the Commonwealth doesn't want me anymore, but that doesn't mean I'm going to let Lavanna come down here and dig her claws into my country and ruin it like she ruined yours.
Ours, he reminded her.
Ours.
He shook a strand of hair out of his face. So that's it? Some overzealous sense of patriotism for a country that's trying to hunt you down as we speak? You do have some fried wires.
In case you didn't realize it, the second you step foot on Commonwealth soil, you're dead.
Thanks for that stellar vote of confidence. And you don't really seem like the type of girl to sacrifice herself over some hyped-up delusions of true love. So what aren't you telling me?
Cinder turned away.
Oh, come on. Please don't tell me you're obsessing over this wedding because you actually think you're in love with him.
I am, said Aiko. Madly.
Cinder massaged her temple. After an awkward silence, Aiko said,
We're still talking about Kai, right?
Where did you even find her? Said Jason, gesturing at the ceiling speakers.
I'm not just doing this for Kai. Cinder dropped her hand to her side. I'm doing this because I'm the only one who can. I'm going to overthrow Lavanna. I'm going to make sure she can't hurt anyone else.
Jason gaped at her like she'd just sprouted an android arm from the top of her head. You think that you are capable of overthrowing Lavanna?
Screaming, Cinder threw her arms into the air. That's kind of the whole idea.
Don't you? Isn't that the entire reason you're helping us? Stars, no. I'm not crazy. I'm here because I saw an opportunity to get away from that thaumaturge without getting killed. And... he cut himself off. And what? His jaw flexed.
And what?
And it's what Her Highness would have wanted me to do. Although now, she's probably going to die for it.
Cinder furrowed her brow.
What? And now I'm stuck with you and some backward plan you have that's going to get us all back to square one, right in the hands of Queen Lavanna.
What? But, Her Highness, what are you even talking about?
Princess Winter, who do you think?
Princess...
Cinder drew a step away from him.
You mean the Queen's stepdaughter?
Ooh, said Aiko.
Yeah, the only princess we've got, if you haven't noticed. Who did you think I was talking about?
Cinder gulped. Her gaze flickered to the net screen, where their original plan had long since been hidden beneath news feeds and that blasted clock.
Jason had never been told about their intentions of interrupting the wedding and announcing her identity to the world.
Nobody? She stammered, scratching her wrist. So, when you say you're loyal to your princess, you're talking about her, right?
Jason peered at her like he couldn't figure out why he was wasting his time with such an idiot.
Cinder cleared her throat. Right.
I should have let Sybil have you, he muttered, shaking his head. I thought maybe the princess would be proud if she heard about me turning against Sybil, that she would approve of my decision. But who am I kidding? She'll never even know.
Do you love her?
He glared at her, disgusted. Don't try to push your swoony psychodrama on me. I'm sworn to protect her. Can't very well do that from down here, can I?
Protect her from what? Lavanna?
Among other things.
Cinder collapsed onto one of the storage crates, feeling like she'd just sprinted halfway across the desert. Her body was drained, her brain frazzled. Jason didn't care about her at all. He was loyal to the Queen's stepdaughter. She hadn't even known the Queen's stepdaughter had people who were loyal to her.
Help me, she said, not hiding the pleading in her tone as she met Jason's gaze again.
I swear to you, I can stop Lavanna. I can get you back to Luna
where you can protect your princess or do whatever you need to do. But I need help.
That much is pretty obvious. Are you going to let me in on this miracle plan of yours?
She gulped. Maybe. Eventually. He shook his head, looking like he wanted to laugh as he gestured out toward the streets of Farafra.
You're just desperate because the strongest ally you have right now is lying in a drug-induced coma.
Wolf is going to be fine, Cinder said, with more conviction than she expected. Then she sighed. I'm desperate because I need as many allies as I can get.
Chapter 36. They stopped again that night, and Cress was given some bread, dried fruit, and water. She listened to the sounds of camp outside the van and tried to sleep, but it came only in fits. They started early again the next morning. She became less and less sure that Thorn would come for her. She kept seeing him embracing that other woman, and imagined that he was glad he no longer had to bother himself with the weak, naive lunar shell. Even the fantasies that had consoled and comforted her for so many years aboard the satellite were growing feeble. She was not a warrior, brave and strong and ready to defend justice. She was not the most beautiful girl in the land, able to evoke empathy and respect from even the most hard-hearted villain. She was not even a damsel knowing that a hero would someday rescue her. Instead, she spent the agonizing hours wondering whether she was to become a slave, a servant, a feast for cannibals, a human sacrifice, or whether she would be returned to Queen Levana and tortured for her betrayal. Eventually, late in the second day of her entrapment, the vans stopped and the doors were thrown open. Cress cringed at the brightness and tried to scuffle away, but she was grabbed and hauled outside. She landed on her knees. Pain shot up her spine, but her captor ignored her whimpering as he tugged her to her feet and bound her wrists. The pain soon faded, trounced by adrenaline and curiosity. They'd arrived at a new town, but even she could tell this one had never been as wealthy or populated as Khufra. Modest buildings the color of the desert stretched down a sand-spotted road. Walls of red clay, painted indigo and pink, had long been bleached in the sun, their roofs covered with broken tiles. A fenced area not far away held half a dozen camels, and there were a few more wheeled, dirty vehicles stationed along the street, and she blinked the sun and sand from her eyes. A spaceship sat in the center of town. A Rampian. Her heart skipped with frenzied hope, but it was quickly smothered. Even from this distance, she could see that the Rampian's main hatch was painted black, not adorned with a lounging lady, as had been reported when Thorn's ship landed in France. She whimpered, tearing her eyes away as her captors herded her into the nearest building. They entered a dark hallway. Only a small window in the front let in any light, and it had been caked with wind-blown sand over the years. There was a tiny desk set into a corner with a board of old-fashioned keys hanging on the wall. Cress was shuffled past it and taken to the end of the corridor. The walls reeked with something pungent. Not a bad scent, but too overpowering to be pleasant. Cress's nose tickled. She was pushed up a staircase, so thin that she had to follow behind Gina, with Niels behind her. An eerie silence haunted the sand-colored walls. The stench was stronger up here, and a shiver raced down her spine, making goosebumps bloom across her arms. Her fear had bundled itself up in a cluster of nerves at the base of her spine. By the time they reached the last door in the hallway, and Gina raised her fist to knock, Cress was shaking so hard she almost couldn't stand. She was surprised to find herself longing for the security of the van. Gina had to knock twice before they heard footsteps and the creak of the door. Niels kept Cress tucked securely behind Gina, and all she could see were the cuffs of a man's brown trousers and worn white shoes with fraying laces.
Gina, said a man,
sounding like he'd just woken from a nap.
I heard a rumor out of Kufra that you were on your way.
I've brought you another subject. Found her wandering in the desert.
A hesitation. Then the man said without question,
a shell.
His certainty made Kress squirm. If he had not had to ask, that meant he could sense her, or rather, couldn't sense her. She remembered Sybil complaining that she could not sense Kress's thoughts, how much more difficult it was to train and command a person like her, as if it were all Kress's doing. This man was lunar. She flinched away, wanting to curl up until she was no larger than a grain of sand, until she blew away into the desert and disappeared. But she could not disappear. Instead, as Gina stepped aside, she found herself face to face with a man well into his years. She started. They were face to face. He was barely taller than her. Behind a pair of thin wired spectacles, his blue eyes widened, looking remarkably lively despite the wrinkles that folded and creased around them. He was balding, with tufts of untamed gray hair that stuck out above his ears. A bizarre déjà vu struck her, as if she'd seen him before, but that was impossible. He whipped off his spectacles and rubbed at his eyes. When he replaced them, his lips were puckered, and he was examining Kress like a bug for dissection. She pressed back against the wall until Niels grabbed her elbow and yanked her forward.
Definitely a shell, the old man murmured, and a phantom, it seems.
Kress's heart pounded a rough, erratic rhythm against her ribcage.
I'm asking 32,000 units for her.
The man blinked at Gina like he'd forgotten she was there. He stood a bit straighter and made a great fuss about removing his spectacles again, to clean them this time. Kress dug her fingernails into her palm to distract herself from her panic. She stared past the man. A single window was covered in blinds, and there was dust swirling in and out of a beam of sunlight that knifed through them. There was a closed door, presumably a closet, a desk, a bed, and a pile of rumpled blankets in the corner. The blankets were clotted with blood. A chill raced across her skin. Then she spotted the net screen.
A net screen. She could come for help. She could contact the last hotel in Kufra. She could tell Thorn,
I will give you 25,000.
The man's tone had solidified while he cleaned his glasses and was now all business. Gina snorted.
I will not hesitate to take this girl to the police and have her deported. I'll collect my citizens' reward from them. A mere 1,500 units? You would sacrifice so much on your pride, Gina? My pride, and to know that one less Luna is walking around on my planet.
She said this with a sneer, and for the first time, it occurred to Kress that Gina might truly hate her, for no other reason than her ancestry.
I let her go for 30,000, Doctor. I know you're paying as much for shells these days.
Doctor? Kress gulped. This man in no way resembled the finely polished men and women in the net dramas, with their crisp white coats and advanced technology. Somehow the title served to make her more wary, as visions of scalpels and syringes flashed through her mind. He sighed.
27,000.
Gina tilted her head back, peered down her nose.
Deal.
The doctor took her hand, but he seemed to have drawn back into himself. He couldn't look at Kress full on, as if he were ashamed that she had witnessed the transaction. Defiance jolted down Kress's spine. He should be ashamed. They should all be ashamed. And she would not let herself become mere baggage to be bartered for. Mistress Sybil had taken advantage of her for too long. She wouldn't let it happen again. Before these thoughts could become anything more than rebellious anger, she was shoved into the room. Gina shut the door, enclosing them all in the hot, dusty space that smelled of stale chemicals.
Make the transfer quick, she said, folding her arms. I have other business to tend to in Kufra.
The doctor grunted and opened the closet.
There were no clothes inside, but rather a miniature science lab with mystery machines and scanners and a stand of metal drawers that clanked when he opened them. He pulled out a needle and syringe and made quick work of removing its packaging. Cress backed away, arms pulling against her bindings, but Niels stopped her.
"Yes, yes, let me get a blood sample from her, then I'll make the transfer."
"Why?" Gina said, stepping between them. "So you can determine something's wrong with her and compromise our deal?"
The doctor harumphed.
"I have no intention of compromising anything, Gina. I merely thought she would be more complicit while you're here, allowing me to more safely extract the sample."
Cress's gaze darted around the room. A weapon, an escape, a hint of mercy in the eyes of her captor. Nothing. There was nothing.
"Fine," Gina said. "Niels, hold her so the doctor can do what he needs to do."
"No!"
The word was ripped out of Cress as she stumbled away. Her shoulder collided with Niels, and she started to fall backward. But then he was gripping her by the elbow and hauling her against him. Her legs had become soggy and useless beneath her.
"No, please, leave me alone,"
she pleaded at the doctor, and saw such a mixture of emotion on his lined face that she fell silent. His eyebrows were bunched together, and his mouth tightly pursed. He kept rapidly blinking behind his glasses, like trying to clear away an eyelash, until his gaze fell away from her altogether. There was pity in him. She knew it. She knew this was sympathy he was trying to disguise.
"Please,"
she sobbed.
"Please let me go. I'm just a shell, and I'm stranded here on Earth, and I haven't done anything to anyone, and I'm nobody. I'm nobody. Please just let me go."
He did not meet her eyes again, even as he stepped forward. She tensed, trying to back away, but Niels held her firm. The doctor's touch felt papery, but his grip was strong as he took her wrist in one hand.
"Try to relax," he murmured.
She flinched as the needle dug into her flesh, the same spot where Sybil had taken blood 100 times. She bit hard on the inside of her cheek, refusing to so much as whimper.
"That was all. Not so awful, was it?"
His tone was eerily soft, like he was trying to comfort her. She felt like a bird who'd had her wings clipped and been thrown into a cage. Another filthy, rotting cage. She'd been in a cage all her life. Somehow, she'd never expected to find one just as awful on Earth. Earth, she reminded herself as the doctor plodded back across the groaning floorboards. She was on Earth, not trapped in a satellite in space. There was a way out of this. Freedom was just out that window, or just down those stairs. She would not be a prisoner again. The doctor fit the syringe full of her blood into a machine and flipped on a port screen.
"There now, I will transfer over the funds and you can be on your way." "You're using a secure connection?"
Gina asked, taking a step forward as the doctor tapped in some sort of code word. Cress squinted, watching where his fingers landed in case she would later need it. It could save time not having to hack it.
"Trust me, Gina. I have more reason than you to keep my transactions hidden from prying eyes."
He studied something on the screen, before saying more solemnly,
"Thank you for bringing her."
Gina scowled at his balding head.
"I hope you're killing all these Lunas when you're done with them. We have enough problems with the plague. We don't need them, too."
His blue eyes flashed, and Cress detected a hint of disdain for Gina, but he covered it over with another benign look.
"The payment has been transferred. If you would untie the girl before you go..."
Cress kept still as the bindings were taken off her wrists. She whipped her hands away as soon as they were gone and scurried against the nearest wall.
"Lovely doing business with you again," Gina said.
The doctor merely grunted. He was watching Cress from the corner of his eye, trying to stare at her without being obvious. And then the door closed and Gina and Niels were gone. Cress listened to their feet clopping down the hallway, the only noise in the building. The doctor rubbed his palms down the front of his shirt, like cleansing them of Gina's presence. Cress didn't think he could feel half as filthy as she did,
but she stayed as still as the wall, glaring.
Yes, well, he said. It's more awkward with shells, you know, not so easy to explain.
She snarled. You mean, not so easy to brainwash? He tilted his head, and the odd look had returned, the one that made her feel like a science experiment under a microscope.
You know that I'm lunar.
She didn't answer.
I understand you're frightened. I can't imagine what sort of mistreatment Gina and her hooligans put you through, but I'm not going to hurt you. In fact, I'm doing great things here, things that will change the world, and you can help me.
He paused.
What is your name, child?
She didn't answer. When he moved closer, his hands extended in a show of peace. Kresh shoved all her fear down into her gut and used the wall to launch herself at him. A roar clawed up from her throat, and she swung her elbow as hard as she could, landing a solid hit against his jaw. She heard the snap of his teeth, felt the shock in her bones, and then he was falling backward and landing so hard on the wooden floor that the entire building shook around them. She didn't check to see if he was unconscious, or if she'd given him a heart attack, or if he was in any shape to get up and follow her. She wrenched open the door and ran. Chapter 37. Dr. Erland woke up on the floor of a hot, dusty hotel room, unable for a moment to remember where he was. This was not the laboratories beside New Beijing Palace, where he'd watched cyborg after cyborg break into red and purple rashes, where he'd seen the life drain out of their eyes and cursed the sacrifice of another life while plotting the next step in his hunt for the only cyborg that mattered. This was not the labs of Luna, where he'd studied and researched with a singular drive for recognition, where he'd seen monsters born at the end of his surgical tools, where he'd watched the brainwaves of young men take on the chaotic, savage patterns of wild animals. He was not Dr. Dmitri Erland, as he'd been in New Beijing. He was not Dr. Sage Darnell, as he'd been on Luna. Or perhaps he was. He couldn't think, couldn't remember. Didn't care. His thoughts kept turning away from himself and his two hateful identities, and swarming back to his wife's heart-shaped face and honey-blonde hair that became frizzy whenever the ecology department was injecting new humidity into Luna's controlled atmosphere. His thoughts were on a screaming baby, 4 days old and confirmed a shell, as his wife dropped her into the hands of Thaumaturge Mira, with all the coldness and disgust she would have shown a rodent. The last time he'd seen his little crescent moon. He watched the whirling ceiling fan that did nothing to dispel the desert heat and wondered why, after all these years, his hallucinations had chosen this time to torture him. This shell girl did not really have his wife's freckles or blonde hair. This shell girl did not have his unfortunate height or his own blue eyes. This shell girl was not his daughter, returned from the dead to haunt him. The illusion was all in his mind. Perhaps it was fitting. He'd done so many horrible things. The recent attack on Earth was only the culmination of years of his own efforts. It was through his own research that Queen Chanary had begun developing her army of wolf hybrids, and through his experiments that Lavanna was able to see it to its bloody finale. And then there were all those he'd hurt to find Celine and end Lavanna's reign. All those he'd murdered to find Lynn Cinder. He'd been too optimistic to think he could repay those debts now. He'd tried hard to duplicate the antidote Lavanna had given to Emperor Kaito. He'd had to try, and for his pains, more sacrifices, more blood samples, more experiments, though now he was forced to find true volunteers when the traffickers couldn't bring him new blood or their own. He had discovered, back in New Beijing, when he'd studied the antidote brought by Queen Lavanna, that lunar shells held the secret. The same genetic mutation that made them immune to the lunar tampering of bioelectricity could be used to create antibodies
that would fight off and defeat the disease. And so, he'd begun gathering shells and their blood and their DNA, using them just as he'd used the young men who had become mindless soldiers for the Queen, just as he'd used the cyborgs who were too often unwilling candidates of the Letamosis experimentation. Of course his brain would do this to him. Of course his insanity would reach such a depth that the hallucinations would return to him the only thing he had ever cared for. And they would twist reality so that she became just another one of his victims. Just another person bought and discarded. Just another blood sample. Just another lab rat who hated him. His little crescent moon. Over his head, his port screen dinged on his laboratory shelf. It took more energy than he thought he had to pull himself to his feet, groaning as he used the age-polished bedpost for leverage. He took his time, avoiding the truth, partly because he didn't know what he wanted the truth to be. A hallucination he could deal with. He could write it off and continue with his work. But if it was her? He could not lose her one more time. He passed the open closet and pushed aside the window blinds, glancing out onto the street. He could see the curve of the ship two streets away, reflecting the sunlight as dusk set in. He should get this over with before Cinder came back to check on her wolf friend. He had not had any subjects sold to him since she'd been here, and he did not think she would understand. She had such a tough time understanding the sacrifices that had to be made for the good of all. She, who should understand better than anyone. Sighing, he paced back to the small lab setup and the girl's blood sample. He picked up the port screen and clicked on the report generated from the test. He felt woozy as he scanned the data culled from her DNA. Lunar. Shell. Height. Fully grown. 153.48 centimeters. Martin Schultz scale, iris pigmentation, 3. Melanin production, 28/100, with localized concentrated melanin to face, /ephelis. Her physical statistics were followed by a list of potential diseases and genetic weaknesses, with suggestions for treatments and preventions. It did not tell him what he needed to know until he steeled himself and linked her chart to his own, a chart that he had practically memorized for as many times as he had taken his own blood for experimentation. He sat down on the edge of the bed while the computer ran through the charts, comparing and contrasting more than 40,000 genes. He found himself hoping that the hallucination was true and she was not his daughter, that his daughter had been killed by Sybil Mira, as he'd been led to believe so many years ago. Because if it was her, she would despise him. And he would agree with her. She was gone already, he was sure. He didn't know how long he'd been unconscious, but he doubted she would stay close. He had already lost that little ghost. Twice now. The port screen finished running the comparison. Match found. Paternity confirmed. He took off his spectacles and set them on the desk and exhaled a long, trembling breath. His crescent moon was alive. Chapter 38. Cress held her breath and listened. Listened so hard it was giving her a headache. But all she heard was silence. Her left leg was beginning to cramp from being curled into such an awkward position, but she dared not move for fear she would bump something and alert the old man to her location. She hadn't run from the hotel. Though she'd been tempted, she'd known that Gina and the others could still be out there, and running into them would put her right back where she'd started. Instead, she ducked into the third room down the long, slender corridor, surprised to find the door unlocked and the room abandoned. It had the same setup as the doctor's room, bed, closet, desk, but to her chagrin, it was missing a net screen. If she hadn't been so desperate to find a hiding spot, she would have wept. She ended up in the closet. It was empty, with a bar for hanging clothes situated below a single shelf. Cress had used all her strength to clamber up onto that shelf, propelling up the closet's side walls with both feet before squeezing her way into the tiny alcove. She'd used her toes to pull the door shut. For once, she was glad of her small size, and she figured that if he found her, she'd at least have the leverage from being so high up. She wished she would have thought to grab some sort of weapon. But her hope was that there would be no need for it. She suspected that when he woke up, he would think she'd run out into the town and would go searching for her, which should give her ample time to get back to that net screen and contact Thorne at their last hotel. She had lain there for hours, waiting and listening. Though it was uncomfortable, it kind of reminded her of sleeping beneath the bed in the satellite during those long hours when Luna could be seen through her windows. She'd always felt safe then, and the memory brought a strange sense of protection, even now. After a while, she began to wonder whether she'd killed the man. The guilt that sparked in her chest made her angry. She had nothing to feel guilty about. She'd been defending herself, and he was a lunar trafficking monster. Not long after she'd had this thought, she heard shuffling, so quiet it could have been a mouse in the walls. It was followed by a couple of thumps and a groan. Her body seized up again, her right shoulder aching from the way she was lying on it. This had been a mistake. She should have run when she'd had the chance. Or she should have used the time that he was unconscious to tap into his net screen. In hindsight, she'd had plenty of time, but now it was too late, and he was awake, and he would find her, and... She squeezed her eyes shut until white specks flickered in the darkness. Her plan had not failed yet. He could still go outside in search of her. He could still leave the building. She waited. And waited. Breathing in and breathing out, filling herself with hot, stifling air. Her pulse skipped at every sound. Every muffled scrape, every wooden thump, trying to create a picture in her mind of what was happening in the room at the end of the hall. He never left his room. He didn't come to look for her at all. She scowled into the darkness, a bead of sweat lobbed its way off her nose. When solid darkness had crept into her closet and, despite the discomfort and stiff muscles, Cress found herself dozing off. She snapped herself awake and determined that she had hidden long enough. The old man wasn't searching for her, which seemed absurd, knowing how much he'd paid for her. Shouldn't he have been a little more concerned? Or maybe all he'd really wanted was her blood. It was a peculiar coincidence, given how Mr. Sybil had saved so many non-gifted infants from death because she'd seen some value in their blood, too. She tried not to let her suspicions and paranoia dig any deeper. Whatever the old man wanted, she couldn't stay in this closet forever. Tilting one foot off the shelf, she nudged open the closet door. It squeaked, a sound that was drum-shatteringly loud, and she froze with one leg extended, waiting, listening. When nothing happened, she prodded the door open a bit more and shimmied to the edge of the shelf. She lowered herself as gently as she could down to the floor. The floorboards groaned. She halted again, heartbeat thundering. Waited. Listened. Dizzy and parched, Cress made her way to the corridor. It was empty. She crept to the next door. Again, it was unlocked, but the room looked exactly like the one she'd just left. Abandoned and empty. Her skin was crawling, every sense heightened as she shut the door and moved on to the next. In the third room, the blinds were closed, but the light from the corridor fell on a net screen hanging in the darkness. She barely stifled a gasp. Trembling with anticipation, she shut the door behind her. Then her attention landed on the bed, and she pressed a hand over her mouth. A man was lying there. Sleeping, she realized, as she waited for her heartbeat to stop thudding so painfully against her ribs. She dared not move until she could be certain that the rise and fall pattern of his chest was steady and deep. She hadn't woken him. She glanced at the net screen again, weighing the risks. She could slip into the corridor again and keep searching. There were two doors on this floor she hadn't yet opened, but they were both back toward the old man's room. Or
she could go downstairs and try her luck there. But every step she took on the old floorboards could alert someone to her presence, and she had no guarantee that any of the other doors would be unlocked, or that they would have net screens. The minutes ticked by as she stood with one hand on the doorknob, the other over her mouth, trapped by indecision. The man never stirred, never so much as twitched. Finally, she forced herself to take a step toward the net screen. Her gaze darted to the sleeping form again and again, making sure that his breathing didn't change. "Net screen," she whispered. "On." The screen flickered and she began repeating. "Net screen mute. Net screen mute. Net screen—" But her command was unnecessary. As the net screen brightened, she found herself staring at a map of Earth, not at a net drama or newsfeed. Four locations had been marked: New Beijing, Paris, Rieux, France, a tiny oasis town in the northwest corner of Nile Province in the African Union. A sense of coincidence stirred in her, but her brain was already skimming too far ahead to dwell on it. Within moments, she had sent the map away and called up a comm link. She hesitated. The only time she'd ever sent a comm was when she talked to Cinder, using a link that couldn't be traced or monitored. She knew intimately how much access Queen Lavanna had to Earth's net and all those comms that Earthans mistakenly believed were private. But she couldn't dwell on that. What interest would Queen Lavanna have in a single comm link established between two small towns in North Africa? She was, no doubt, far too preoccupied with her plans for intergalactic dominance. "Net screen," she whispered. "Show hotels in Kufra." Her awkward pronunciation brought up a list of 7 possible Kufras. She selected the one with the least distance from her current location and was then faced with the names of 12 lodging options, their ads and contact information flashing on the sidebar. She scowled, reading each carefully. None of their names sounded familiar. "Show in map." The city of Kufra spilled out across the screen, a satellite-taken photograph that, after a moment of squinting at the brown-tinted roads, began to breach the gaps in her memory. Then she spotted a courtyard outside one of the hotels and, after zooming onto the photo, recognized a lemon tree standing against one wall. She dared to smile and tapped on the hotel's contact information. "Establish comm link." Within seconds, she found herself staring at the same clerk who had checked her in with Thorne, with Gina's help. She nearly collapsed with relief.
"Thank you for coming."
"Shh." Cress waved her arms, silencing the woman, and glanced at the man on the bed. He twitched, but only briefly.
"Sorry," she whispered.
The woman leaned closer toward the screen to hear her.
"My friend is sleeping. I need to speak with a guest at your hotel. His name is Carswell Smith. I believe he's in room 8.
She was glad when the woman's voice dropped low.
"One moment."
She tapped something off screen. Cress jumped at a ping, but the man slept on. An alert appeared in the corner of the net screen. 97 new alerts regarding search Lynn Cinder. She blinked. Lynn Cinder?
"I'm sorry,"
said the receptionist, snapping Cress's attention back to her.
"Mr. Smith left the hotel yesterday evening after causing a commotion with some of our other guests."
Her eyes had become suspicious as she scanned the dark room with increased curiosity.
"In fact, we're currently undergoing an investigation, as some witnesses believe he may have been a wanted—"
Cress canceled the link. Her nerves were writhing beneath her skin, and her lungs felt too small to take in all the air they needed. Thorne wasn't there. He'd had to run, and now she had no idea how to find him, and he was being hunted, and he would be captured, and she would never see him again. The screen pinged again. The alerts on Lynn Cinder had increased by 2. Lynn Cinder, New Beijing, Paris, Rieux, France. The sequence began to click. Baffled, Cress pulled up the alerts.
They were the same news stories she'd been wading through for weeks aboard the satellite. Criticisms and speculations and conspiracy theories and very little evidence. Still, no confirmed sightings. Still no arrests made, and not even a mention of Captain Thorne, despite what the hotel clerk had said. And then, her attention caught on a headline, and her legs nearly buckled. She splayed her fingers on top of the desk to keep standing. Lunar accomplice, Dimitri Erland, still evading authorities. Dimitri Erland. The lunar doctor who had been on the Letimosis research team. The doctor who had helped Cinder escape from prison. The doctor who was, perhaps, the second most wanted fugitive on Earth, even more so than Thorne. She knew it was him even before she pulled up his picture. This was why the old man had struck her as familiar. She had seen him before. But wasn't he supposed to be on their side? She was so engrossed with her unanswered questions that she didn't hear the subtle creaking of the bed until a hand grabbed her. Chapter 39. Cress squeaked as she was spun around. She found herself staring into a face that was both handsome and murderous, his eyes glowing in the light of the net screen.
Who are you?
Her instinct was to scream, but she smothered it, choking off the noise until it was little more than a whimper.
I'm sorry for intruding, she said. I needed a net screen. My friend is in danger, and I needed to send a comm, and I'm so sorry. I promise I didn't steal anything. Please, don't call for the doctor, please.
He seemed to have stopped listening to her, instead sending his steely gaze around the room. He released her arm, but remained tense and defensive. He wasn't wearing a shirt, but he had bandages around his torso that covered him almost as much as a shirt would have.
Where are we? What happened?
His words were staggered and slurred. He grimaced, squeezing his eyes shut, and when he opened them again, it seemed that he couldn't quite focus on anything. That's when Cress's attention caught on something more terrifying than his faded scars and intimidating muscles. He had a tattoo on his arm. It was too dark to read it, but Cress knew instantly what it was. She'd seen them in countless videos and photographs and documentaries hastily cobbled together. He was a lunar special operative, one of the Queen's mutants. Visions of men digging their claws into their victims' chests, locking their jaws around exposed throats, howling at the moon, curled and crawled through her head. This time, she couldn't temper the instinct. She screamed. He grabbed her and forced her jaw shut with his enormous hands. She sobbed, trembling. She was about to die. Her body would pose no more resistance to him than a twig. He snarled, and she could make out the sharp points of his teeth.
You should have killed me when you had the chance,
he said, his breath hot on her face.
You turned me into this, and I will kill you before I become another experiment. Do you understand me?
Tears began to work their way out of her lashes. Her jaw was aching where he held her, but she was more afraid of what would happen when he let go. Did he think she worked for the doctor? Could it be that he was just one more victim sold off to the old man? He was lunar, so they had that much in common. If she could convince him that they were allies, maybe she could get away long enough to run, but could these monsters even be reasoned with?
Do you understand me?
Her lashes fluttered, and the door behind him opened. His moves were fast and fluid, and Cress's head spun as the man turned and pulled her in front of him, plastering her against his chest. He stumbled as if the sudden movement had made him dizzy, but caught himself as light spilled into the room. A silhouette stood in the doorway. Not the old man, but a guard. A lunar guard. Cress's eyes widened with recognition. Sybil's guard. The pilot in Sybil's pod ship. Who could have saved her but didn't? The wolf operative hissed. Cress would have collapsed if his grip hadn't been so firm. Sybil had found her. Sybil was here. Her tears began to spill over. She was trapped. She was dead.
Take one step and I'll snap her neck.
The guard said nothing. Cress wasn't sure he'd even heard the threat. His eyebrows were raised as he surveyed the scene, and he seemed to recognize her, but rather than look victorious, he seemed merely stunned.
What have... Scarlet?
The words were almost incomprehensible beneath a growl.
Where's Scarlet?
Aren't you that hacker? Said the guard, still staring at Cress.
The operative's grip tightened.
You have 5 seconds to tell me where she is, or this girl is dead, and you're next.
I'm not with them, Cress choked. He doesn't care about me.
The guard raised his hands in a placating gesture. Cress wondered where Mistress Sybil was. When the operative's hold didn't loosen, it occurred to her that both of these men worked for the Lunar Queen. Why would they be threatening each other?
Just relax, said the guard. Let me get Cinder or the doctor. They can explain.
The operative flinched.
Cinder?
She's out in the ship.
His gaze dipped again to Cress.
Where do you come from?
She gulped, her head ringing with the same question the operative had posed.
Cinder?
What's going on here?
She shuddered at the doctor's voice, stronger than it had been during his negotiations with Gina. Then, footsteps. The guard stepped aside to let the doctor into the room, still dark but for the corridor light. Cress couldn't help but feel a sting of pride to see that she'd left a mark on his jaw. Though lots of good her newfound courage had done her in the end. The doctor froze and took in the scene.
Oh, stars, he muttered. Of all the bad timings.
Though the sight of him reignited Cress's hatred, she also remembered that this was not just some cruel old man who traded for lunar slaves. This was the man who had helped Cinder escape. Her head spun.
Let her go, said the doctor, speaking gently. We are not your enemies. That girl is not your enemy. Please, allow me to explain.
Wolf pulled an arm away from her, dragging a hand down his face. He swayed for a moment before recovering his balance.
I've been here before, he muttered. Cinder, Africa?
Loud thumping on the distant staircase intruded on his confusion. Then there was yelling, and Cress thought she heard her name, and the voice?
Cress!
She cried out, forgetting about the vice-like grip around her, except that it kept her from launching herself toward him.
Captain!
Cress!
The doctor and the guard both spun around as the footsteps barreled down the hall, and they all watched as Captain Thorne, blindfolded, ran right past the door.
Captain! I'm in here!
The footsteps stopped and reversed as he ran back until his cane smacked the doorframe. He froze, panting, one hand braced on the jamb. He had a furious bruise across one side of his face, though it was largely hidden by the bandana.
Cress, are you all right?
Her relief didn't last.
Captain, to your left there's a lunar guard, and on your right is a doctor who's running tests on lunars, and I'm being held by one of Lavanna's wolf hybrids, and please, be careful!
Thorne took a step back into the hallway and pulled a gun from his waistband. He spent a moment swiveling the barrel of the gun in each direction, but nobody moved to attack him. With some surprise, Cress realized that the operative's grip had weakened. Thorne furrowed his brow, aiming the gun somewhere near the window.
Could you describe all those threats again, because I feel like I missed something?
Thorne?
He pointed the gun toward Wolf, and Cress between them.
Who said that? Who are you? Have you hurt her? Because I swear, if you hurt her—
The lunar guard reached forward and plucked the gun out of his hand.
Hey!
Furious, Thorne raised his cane, but the guard easily blocked the blow with his forearm, then took the cane away too. Thorne raised his fists.
That's enough, yelled the doctor.
No one is hurt, and no one is going to get hurt.
Snarling, Thorne turned to face him.
That's what you think, Wolfman, doctor.
Wait. Cress, which one is this?
I am Dr. Dimitri Erland, and I am a friend of Lynn Cinder's. You might know me as the man who helped her escape from New Beijing prison.
Thorne snorted.
Nice story, except I'm pretty sure I'm the one who helped Cinder escape from prison.
Hardly.
The man you just hit is also an ally of Cinder's, as is the lupine soldier who is still on heavy painkillers and probably delirious, and who will no doubt pull out some stitches if he doesn't lie down right away.
Thorn, the operative said again, ignoring the doctor's warnings. What's going on? Where are we? What happened to your eyes?
Thorn cocked his head.
Wait. Wolf?
Yes. There was a long, long pause before understanding filled Thorn's expression, and he laughed.
Aces, Cress, you nearly gave me a heart attack with that wolf hybrid comment. Why didn't you just tell me it was him?
Where's
Cinder? Asked Thorn.
I don't know, said Wolf. And where? I thought Cinder said something about Scarlet before.
With one arm still loosely tied around Cress's neck, he dragged his free hand down his face, moaning.
Just a nightmare?
Cinder is here. She's safe, said the doctor. Thorn grinned, the biggest, most enigmatic grin Cress had seen since the satellite. Cress gaped around the room, nearly hyperventilating as her worldview flip-flopped before her. Sybil's guard, who she had last seen on his way to board the Rampion. Could he have betrayed Sybil and joined them? The doctor who had helped Cinder escape from prison. The wolf operative. Only now, with Thorn's recognition, did she realize that this was the man she'd seen on the video feed when they'd first contacted her. And somewhere, Cinder.
Safe.
They were safe. Thorn held out his hand, and the guard put the cane back into it.
Cress, are you all right?
He crossed the room and bent down as if he could inspect her, or kiss her, though he didn't.
Are you hurt?
No, I'm all right. The words were so foreign, so impossible, so liberating.
How did you find me?
One of Gina's men told me the name of this place. And all I had to do was mention Crazy Doctor to the folks outside, and they all knew just who I was talking about. Knees suddenly weak, she reached for his forearms to stabilize herself.
You came for me.
He beamed, looking for all the world like a selfless, daring hero.
Don't sound so surprised.
Dropping the cane, he pulled her into a crushing embrace that tore her away from Wolf and lifted her clean off the floor.
It turns out, you are worth a lot of money on the black market.
Chapter 40 Cinder stood with her hair pinched back in both hands, and the palace blueprint blurring on the net screen before her. She'd been staring at it all day, but her brain kept running in circles.
All right, what if...
If the doctor and I could get some invitations and sneak in as guests, and then Jason could create a diversion.
Or no, if you created a diversion and Jason came as one of the staff,
but the doctor is so well known. Maybe Jason and I could enter as guests, and the doctor... But then how would we... She threw her head back and glowered at the ship's metal ceiling with its crossed wires and air ducts. Maybe I'm overcomplicating this. Maybe I should go in alone.
Yes, because you aren't recognizable at all, said Aiko, punctuating her statement by pulling up Cinder's prison photo in the blueprints corner.
Cinder groaned. This was never going to work.
Oh, Cinder!
She jolted.
What?
This just came across the local news feed.
Aiko wiped away the blueprint and replaced it with a map of the Sahara Desert. A journalist was speaking in the background, and as they watched, a circle was drawn around some nearby cities, with lines and arrows connecting them. A ticker read, Wanted Criminal, Carswell Thorn Spotted in Sahara Trading City, Evades Capture. As the journalist jabbered on, Thorn's prison photo flashed on the screen, followed by the words bright and bold. Armed and dangerous, calm authorities immediately with any information. Cinder's stomach twisted, first with remorse, then with panic.
It was a false alarm. Thorn was dead. Someone must have seen a lookalike and jumped to conclusions. It wasn't the first time. According to the media, Cinder had been spotted multiple times in every Earthen country, sometimes in multiple locations at once. But that didn't matter. If people believed they'd seen the real thing, then they would come. Law enforcement, the military, bounty hunters. The desert was about to be flooded with people searching for them, and the Rampian was still sitting, obvious and enormous, in the middle of a tiny oasis town.
"We can't stay here," she said, pulling on her boots. "I'll go get the others. Iko, run the system diagnostics. Make sure we're set for space travel again."
She was down the ramp before Iko could respond, jogging toward the hotel. She hoped it wouldn't take long for the doctor to pack up his things and Wolf. She hoped his wounds had healed enough that it would be all right to move him. The doctor had started reducing his dosages. Would it be safe to wake him? As she rounded the corner to the hotel, she spotted a girl leaning against an electric vehicle. The car was just old enough to be beat up and grungy, but not old enough to have gained any vintage appeal. On the other hand, the girl was perhaps in her late teens and gorgeous, with light brown skin and braids dyed in shades of blue. Cinder slowed, preparing for a fight. She didn't recognize the girl as one of the townspeople, and something felt wrong about her, though she couldn't place it. Was she a bounty hunter? An undercover detective? The girl's expression stayed blank and bored as Cinder approached. No outward recognition. That was good. But then she smiled and twirled one of her silky braids around a finger.
"Lynn Cinder, such a pleasure. My master has spoken so highly of you."
Cinder paused and studied her again.
"Who are you?"
"I'm called Darla. I'm Captain Thorne's mistress."
Cinder blinked.
"Excuse me?"
"He asked me to stay and keep watch over the vehicle," she said. "He's just gone inside to be heroic. I'm sure he'll be glad to know you're here. I believe he's under the impression that you're out in space somewhere."
Cinder glanced from the girl to the hotel. When it seemed that the girl had no intention of reaching for a weapon or handcuffs or leaving her post against the car, Cinder pushed open the door. She rushed up the stairs, her mind spinning with the girl's words. It was a joke, or a trap, or a trick. It could not be possible that she was... that Thorn was... Her foot slammed into the landing so hard she was almost surprised it didn't crash through the floorboards. As she turned down the corridor, she saw Jason standing outside Wolf's room, arms crossed.
"Jason, there's a girl down there. She said she..."
He shrugged and gestured toward the room.
"See for yourself."
Using the wall for balance, Cinder joined him in the doorway. Dr. Erland was there, with a sizable bruise on his jaw. And Wolf was awake. And,
stars above,
he was filthy, his clothes ripped and covered in dirt, and his hair as shaggy as it had been the day she'd met him in his prison cell. His face was bruised, stubble was claiming his jawline, and he wore, of all things, a red bandana around his eyes. But he was grinning, with his arm around the waist of a petite blonde girl, and it was undeniably him. It was a few seconds before Cinder found her voice, and she had to grip the doorframe to keep standing.
"Thorn?"
His head jerked around.
"Cinder? What are you... How... Where have you been? What's going on? Why are you wearing that stupid bandana?"
He laughed. Gripping a wooden cane, he stumbled toward her, waving one hand until it landed on her shoulder. Then he was hugging her, suffocating her against his chest.
"I missed you too."
"You jerk," she hissed, even as she returned the hug.
"We thought you were dead."
"Oh, please. It'd take a lot more than a satellite plummeting to Earth to kill me. Although, admittedly, Cress may have saved us that time."
Cinder pushed him away. "What's wrong with your eyes?"
"Blind. It's a long story."
Her tongue flailed around all the questions stammering to get out, and she finally landed on,
"When did you have time to take a mistress?"
His smile faltered. Don't talk about Cress like that.
What?
Oh! Wait, you mean Darla. I won her in a hand of cards.
Cinder gawked.
I thought she'd make a nice gift for Aiko.
You what?
For her replacement body.
Because Darla's an escort droid?
Slow, gradual understanding. An escort droid. That would explain the girl's perfect symmetry and ridiculously lush eyelashes. And the way her presence felt off, because there was no bioelectricity coming off her.
Honestly, Cinder, to listen to you, people would think I'm a helpless flirt or something.
Tipping back on his heels, Thorne gestured toward the blonde girl.
By the way, you remember Cress?
The girl smiled uncomfortably. Only then did Cinder recognize her. Now, with flaking, sunburned cheeks and hair chopped short and uneven.
Hello, said Cinder, although the girl was quick to duck behind Thorne and cast her eyes nervously around all the people in the room.
Cinder cleared her throat.
And, Wolf, you're awake. This is...
Listen, Thorne, you were spotted in a nearby city. They're already pulling together search parties. This whole area is about to be flooded with people searching for us. She faced the doctor. We need to get out of here. Now.
Cinder?
She dared to meet his eyes. His brow was damp with sweat, his pupils dilated.
I had a dream where you said... You told me that Scarlet...
Cinder gulped, wishing she could avoid the inevitable.
Wolf.
He paled, seeing it in her face before she spoke.
It wasn't a dream, she murmured. She was taken.
Wait, what? Thorne lifted his head. What happened? Scarlet was taken by the Thaumaturge after we were attacked. Thorne cursed. Wolf slumped against the wall, his expression hollow. Silence stole into the room, until Cinder forced herself to stand up straighter, to be optimistic, to not lose hope.
We believe she was taken to Luna, she said, and I have an idea for how we can get into Luna without being seen, and how we can find her and save her. And now that we're all together again, I believe it can work. You just have to trust me. And right now, we can't stay here. We have to leave.
She's dead, Wolf whispered. I failed her.
Wolf, she's not dead. You don't know that.
Neither do you.
He hunched over, burying his face behind both hands. His shoulders began to shake, and it was just like before, the way all his energy darkened and thickened around him, the way he seemed empty, missing. Cinder took a step toward him.
She's not dead. They'll want to keep her for bait,
for information. They wouldn't just kill her. So there's still time. There's time to... His anger flared like an explosion. One moment, nothing. Then, a spark. And then suddenly, he was burning up, raging and white hot. He reached for Cinder, turning and pinning her against the wall with such force that the net screen shook and threatened to crash to the floor. Cinder gasped, clamping both hands over Wolf's wrist as he held her suspended by her throat, feet dangling off the ground. The warnings on her retina display were instantaneous. Rising pulse and adrenaline and temperature and irregular breathing and...
You think I want that? He growled. For them to keep her alive? You don't know what they'll do to her. But I do.
In another instant, the fury softened, buried beneath terror and misery.
Scarlet.
He released her, and Cinder collapsed to the ground, rubbing her neck. Over the tumult in her thoughts, she heard Wolf turn and run, his footsteps crashing across the floor, down the hallway toward Dr. Erlon's room. When they stopped, there was a short silence that filled up the entire hotel. And then, howling. Horrible, painful, wretched howling that sank into Cinder's bones and made her stomach turn.
Wonderful, Dr. Erlon drawled. I'm glad to see you are so much more prepared this time.
Hissing around the pain, Cinder used the wall to pull herself to her feet and glanced around at her friends, her allies. Cress was still hiding behind Thorn, her eyes now wide with shock. Jason was fingering the handle of his knife. Dr. Erland, with his messy gray hair and glasses perched at the end of his nose, could not have looked any less impressed.
"You all go ahead," she said, her throat stung.
"Load up the ship. Make sure Iko is ready to go."
Another long, heartbreaking howl shook the hotel, and Cinder steadied herself as well as she could.
"I'll get Wolf." Chapter 41. Cress followed the guard down the hotel steps. Thorn was behind her, one hand on her shoulder and the other gripping his cane. She warned him about the last step as she turned down the dark hallway. Dr. Erland was in the back, already wheezing with the exertion of carrying his prized lab equipment down the stairs. It was difficult for Cress to focus. She wasn't even sure where they were going. The ship, did Cinder say? At the time, Cress had been filled with horror at seeing the lunar operative snap. His howls were still bouncing off her eardrums. The guard shoved open the hotel door and they all scrambled down onto the rough, sand-covered road. Two steps later, he froze, thrusting his arms out to catch Cress, Thorn, and the doctor as they crashed into him. Whimpering, Cress shriveled against Thorn and scanned the road. Dozens of men and women dressed in the official uniform of the Commonwealth military had them surrounded, with guns raised. They filled up the roads and the spaces between buildings, peering down from rooftops and around rust-covered pod ships.
"Cress," Thorn whispered, as tension prickled on the stifling air.
"Military," she murmured. "A lot of them."
Her gaze landed on a girl with blue hair. An instant hatred blossomed inside her chest.
"What is she doing here?"
"What? Who?"
That girl from the last town."
Thorn tilted his head. "That's Darla, the escort droid. Why are you and Cinder so confused about this?"
Her eyes widened. She was an escort droid? The girl was watching them without emotion, sandwiched between two soldiers with her hands hanging limp at her sides.
"I'm sorry, Master," she said, her voice carrying through the silence. "I would have warned you, but that would be illegal, and my programming prevents me from breaking human laws."
"Yeah, that's going to be the first thing we fix," said Thorn, before whispering to Cress. "I had to find one heck of a legal loophole to get her to help me steal that car."
A voice boomed, and it took Cress a moment to spot the man holding a port screen and amplifier to his mouth.
"You are all under arrest for the harboring and assisting of wanted fugitives. Get down on your stomachs and put your hands on your heads and no one will be hurt."
Trembling, Cress waited to see what the guard would do. The gun he'd taken from Thorn was still tucked into his belt, but his hands were full of the doctor's stuff.
"We have you surrounded," the man continued when no one moved. "There is nowhere to run. Get down now."
The guard moved first, lowering himself to his knees and setting down the bag of medical supplies and the strange machine before settling into the dirt. Gulping, Cress followed suit, sinking down to the hard ground. Thorn dropped down beside her.
"Stars above," she heard the doctor moan, grumbling as he joined them on the ground. "I'm too old for this."
Hot and uncomfortable, with rough pebbles pressing into her stomach, Cress set her palms on top of her head. The officer waited until they were on the ground before speaking again.
"Lynn Cinder, we have you surrounded. Come to the front exit immediately with your hands on top of your head, and no one will be hurt."
Cinder released a string of the most creative curses she could think of as the man's voice died away. She left Wolf in the hallway, where he'd been unresponsive to her reminders that having a mental breakdown now wouldn't do anything to help Scarlet.
He had only sat curled in on himself, with his head tucked against his knees, saying nothing. Ducking into the doctor's hotel room, Cinder inched her way to the window and peeled open the blinds. The rooftop directly opposite the alley had two armed military officers with guns pointed right at her. She dropped the blinds and cursed again, plastering herself to the wall. A comm from Iko appeared in her vision. She pulled it up, already fearing what it would say.
"Radar is picking up military ships from the Commonwealth. I think we've been spotted."
"Do you think?" she muttered.
Shutting her eyes, she jotted back a fast message, words scrolling across her eyelids as she thought them. "At the hotel, surrounded by EC military. Prepare for immediate takeoff. We won't be long. I hope." Letting out a slow breath, she pried open her eyes again. How was she supposed to get a mid-crisis Wolf operative, a blind man, an elderly doctor, past all those soldiers without getting anyone killed? She doubted the girl would be much help. Crest didn't strike Cinder as the bold, risk-taking type, and Cinder doubted she'd had much experience fighting her way out of situations like this. She could abandon her friends and make a run for it herself. She could try to control Wolf and use him as a weapon, but even he couldn't take on that many soldiers at once, and they wouldn't hesitate to kill him. She could try to brainwash the soldiers so they wouldn't let them pass, but she'd have to abandon Wolf if he didn't come willingly. Outside, the officer repeated his commands again and again, like a robot. Squaring her shoulders, she returned to Wolf in the hallway. "Wolf," she said, stooping beside him, "I need you to help me out here." He shifted enough to peer at her over his arm. His green eyes looked dull and faded. "Wolf, please, we need to get to the ship, and there are a lot of people with guns out there. Come on, what would Scarlet want you to do?" His fingers curled, nails digging into his thighs. Still, he said nothing, made no move to get up. The officer's voice boomed again.
"You are under arrest. Come out with your hands on your head. We have you surrounded."
"Fine. You leave me no choice." Standing, she forced her shoulders to relax. The world shifted around her as she flipped off the panic and desperation and reached out instead for the energy crackling around Wolf. Except this time it wasn't crackling. Not like usual. This time, it was like controlling a corpse. They stepped into the doorway together. At least 60 guns pointed at them that she could see. No doubt more hidden behind buildings and vehicles. Jason, Thorne, Dr. Erland, and Kress were all lying on the ground. Two streets separated them from the ship. She kept feeding lies to Wolf like medicine from a drip. "Scarlet will be fine. We will find her. We will save her. But first, we have to get out of this mess. We have to get to the ship." From the corner of her eye, she saw his fingers twitch, but she didn't know whether he was acknowledging that there was still hope out there, or whether he was just ticked at her for using him like this, turning him into a puppet. Just like the thaumaturge that had turned him into a monster. Standing on the hotel step, with 60 guns trained on her, Cinder realized she was no better than the thaumaturge. This really was war. And she really was in the middle of it. If she had to make sacrifices, she would. What did that make her, anyway? A real criminal? A real threat? A real loner?
"Put your hands on your head and walk away from the building. Do not make any sudden movements. We are authorized to kill if necessary."
Cinder coerced Wolf to stay beside her. They walked in unison. The dusty air clouded around them, sticking to her skin. A dull ache was spreading through her head, but it wasn't anywhere near as difficult to control Wolf as it used to be. In fact, how easy it was made her sick. He wasn't even trying to fight her.
"About time," Thorne muttered as she passed.
"Cinder, save yourself," hissed Dr. Erland. She tried her best not to move her lips as she spoke.
"Can you glamour them?" "Stop right there," she obeyed. "On your knees now. Keep your hands up."
Only a few, said Dr. Erland. Maybe together.
She shook her head.
I've got Wolf. On top of that, I can control one Earthen, maybe two.
She clenched her teeth. Despite what the doctor had said, she couldn't just save herself. It wasn't only loyalty and friendship that made every fiber of her body rebel against the notion that she could abandon them all. It was the knowledge that without them, she was useless. She needed them to stop the wedding and rescue Kai. She needed them to get her to Luna. She needed them to help her save the world.
Jason, can you control any of them?
Yeah, right.
She could practically hear his eyes roll.
The only way through this is to fight.
Thorn grunted.
In that case, has anyone seen my gun?
I've got it, said Jason.
Can I have it back?
Nope.
I order you to stop talking, the man bellowed. I see any more lips move, and that person gets a bullet in their head. Understand? Get down!
Cinder made a point to glare at the man as she took another step forward. Like dominoes pushed over, she heard the unlatching of 60 safety mechanisms around her. Cress whimpered. Thorn's hand fumbled around until it was gripping hers.
I have 6 tranquilizers, Cinder said. Let's hope it's enough.
It won't be, muttered Jason.
This is your last warning!
Cinder tilted her chin up, fixing her gaze on the man. Beside her, Wolf lowered himself into a fighting position, his fingers curled and ready, all at Cinder's urging. For the first time, she felt a spike of new emotion from him. Hatred, she thought. For her. She ignored it.
This is your first warning, she said.
Holding Wolf at the ready, she pinpointed one of the earthen soldiers who was standing at the front of the line and plucked out her willpower. The young woman swiveled and pointed her gun at the man who was evidently in charge. The woman's eyes widened in shock as they took in her own rebellious hands. Around her, 6 more soldiers changed targets, aiming at their own comrades, and Cinder knew they were under Dr. Erland's control. And that was all they had. 7 earthen soldiers at their disposal. Jason's gun, Wolf's fury. It would be a bloodbath.
Stand down and let us pass, Cinder said, and no one will get hurt.
The man narrowed his eyes at her, making a point not to look at his own peer now holding him at gunpoint.
You can't win this.
I didn't say we could, said Cinder, but we can do a lot of damage trying.
She opened the tip of her finger, loading a tranquilizer from the cartridge in her palm, just as a wave of dizziness crashed over her. Her strength was waning. She couldn't hold on to Wolf much longer. If she dropped her control and he snapped again, she didn't know what he would do. Become comatose all over again? Or go on a rampage? Or turn his anger on her and the rest of their friends? Beside her, Wolf growled.
Actually, we can win, said a female voice.
Cinder tensed. There was a pulse in the air, a ripple of uncertainty. The man with the port screen swiveled around as silhouettes began to emerge from around the buildings, creeping down alleyways, materializing in windows and doorways. Men and women, young and old, dressed in their tattered jeans and loose cotton shirts, their headscarves and cotton hats, their tennis shoes and boots. Cinder gulped, recognizing almost all of them from her brief stay in Farafra. Those who had brought her food, those who had helped paint the ship, those who had doodled cyborg designs on their bodies. Her heart lifted for a moment, and then plummeted down into her gut. This would not end well.
This is a matter of international security, said the man. You are all ordered to return to your homes. Anyone who defies this order will be held in contempt of justice by the laws of the Earthen Union.
So hold us in contempt after you let them pass!
Cinder squinted into the glare of the sun, looking for the source of the voice. She spotted the woman from the medical shop, the lunar whose son had killed himself rather than join Levana's guard.
Some of the soldiers diverted their guns, pivoting away from Cinder and aiming into the crowd, but the man with the amplifier held up an arm.
"These people are wanted criminals. We do not wish to use lethal force to apprehend them, but we will if necessary. I urge you to stand down and return to your homes."
His threat was followed by a standstill, though the few civilian faces Cinder could see didn't appear frightened, only determined.
"These people are our friends," said the shopkeeper. "They came here seeking sanctuary, and we're not going to let you come in and take them."
What were they thinking? What could they possibly do? They may have outnumbered the soldiers, but they were unarmed and untrained. If they got in the way, they would be slaughtered.
"You're not giving me a choice," said the man, his knuckles tightening around the port screen. A bead of sweat dripped down the side of his face.
The shopkeeper's tone took on a new venom.
"You have no idea what it's like not to be given a choice."
Her fingers twitched, a gesture virtually unnoticeable, but the effect passed like a shockwave through the crowd. Cinder flinched. Looking around, she saw that many of the townspeople looked suddenly strained, their brows furrowed, their limbs trembling. And all around them, the soldiers began to shift, redirecting their aim, as those controlled by Cinder and Dr. Erland had, until every soldier was targeting his own neighbor, until every soldier had a gun aimed at his own head. Their stunned eyes filled first with disbelief, and then terror. Only the leader was left standing in the middle, gaping at his own troop.
"That's what it's like," said the woman, "to have your own body used against you, to know that your brain has become a traitor. We came to Earth to get away from that, but we're all lost if Lavanna gets her way. Now, I don't know if this young lady can stop her, but it seems she's the only one worth putting any faith into right now. So that's what we're going to do."
Cinder cried out suddenly, pain splitting her skull. Her hold on Wolf and the female soldier snapped. Her knees buckled, but there was an arm suddenly around her waist, holding her up. Panting from the mental exertion, she peered up into Wolf's face. His eyes were bright green again, normal.
"Wolf."
He peeled his gaze away as a gun clattered to the ground. Cinder jumped. The woman she had been controlling was gaping around at her comrades, trembling, not knowing where to look, not knowing what to do. She nervously raised her hands in surrender. Red with anger, the man with the port screen lowered the amplifier. He faced Cinder again, his eyes filled with hatred. Then he tossed his port screen to the ground. Thorn swiveled his head from side to side.
Could someone explain to me?
Later, said Cinder, letting her weight sink against Wolf. Get up. It's time for us to go.
No arguments here, said Thorn, as he and the others clambered to their feet. But does someone think they could grab my escort droid? I kind of went through a lot to get her, and Thorn!
Cinder felt lightheaded and weak as they weaved their way through the stalemate. It felt like walking through a maze of stone sculptures. Stone sculptures who carried big guns and followed them with their eyes, writhing inside with fury and distrust. Cinder tried to meet the gazes of the townspeople, but many of them had their own eyes shut tight and were shaking from concentration. They couldn't hold the soldiers forever. Only the obvious Earthens met her look and nodded with scared, fleeting smiles. Not a fear of their lunar neighbors, she thought, but a fear of what would happen if Lavanna took control of Earth. What would happen if lunars ruled everything? What would happen if Cinder failed? Jason grabbed the escort droid's wrist and pulled her along after them.
That woman was right, Wolf said, when they'd broken away from the crowd,
and the Rampian, their freedom, rose up from the streets in front of them.
There's nothing worse than your own body being used against you.
Cinder stumbled, but Wolf caught her and dragged her a few steps before she found her balance again.
I'm sorry, Wolf, but I had to. I couldn't leave you there.
I know. I understand.
Reaching out, he grabbed a sack out of the doctor's hand, lessening his load as they hurried toward the ship.
but it doesn't change the fact that no one should have that sort of power.
Chapter 42. The Lunar Boy couldn't have been more than 8 years old, and yet Scarlet was certain that she would wring his neck like a chicken if she ever got the chance. He was, without a doubt, the most horrible child that had ever lived. She couldn't help thinking that if all lunar children were like this, their whole society was doomed, and Cinder would be better off letting them destroy themselves. Scarlet didn't know how exactly she had ended up the property of venerable Annotel and his wife and the little monster they'd raised. Maybe it was favoritism from the crown. Or maybe they'd purchased her, like an earthen family might purchase a new android. Either way, for 7 days, she had been the new toy, the new pet, the new test subject. Because at 8 years old, young Master Charlson was learning how to control his lunar gift. Evidently, earthens were great fun to practice on, and Master Charlson had a very sick sense of humor. Chained from a collar around her neck to a bolt in the floor, Scarlet was being kept in what she figured was the boy's playroom. An enormous net screen took up one wall, and countless virtual reality machines and sports tech had been abandoned in the corners, out of her reach. His practice sessions were agony. Since she'd come to the Annotel household, Scarlet had had long-legged spiders crawl up her nose, snakes as long as her arm wriggle their way through her belly button and wind their bodies around her spine, centipedes burrow into her ear canals and creep around the inside of her skull before emerging on her tongue. Scarlet had screamed. She had thrashed. She had gouged her own fingernails into her stomach and blown her nose until it bled in an effort to get the trespassers out. And all the while, Master Charlson had laughed and laughed and laughed. It was all in her head, of course. She knew that. She even knew it when she was roughly banging her head on the floor to try to knock out the spiders and centipedes. But it didn't matter. Her body was convinced. Her brain was convinced. Her rational mind was overcome. She hated that little boy. Hated him. She also hated that she was starting to be afraid of him.
Charlson!
His mother appeared in the doorway, temporarily rescuing Scarlet from his most recent infatuation, squinty-eyed ground moles with their fat bodies and enormous reptilian claws. One had been gnawing at her toes while its talons shredded the sole of her foot. The illusion and the pain vanished, but the horror lingered. The rawness of her throat, the damp salt on her face. Scarlet rolled onto her side, sobbing in the middle of the playroom floor, grateful that the boy couldn't maintain the brainwashing while he was distracted. Scarlet paid no heed to the conversation until Charlson began to yell, and she was forced to open her swollen eyes. The boy was throwing a tantrum. His mother was talking in a soothing voice, trying to appease him, promising something. Charlson, it seemed, was not appeased. A minute later, he stomped out of the room and Scarlet heard a door slam. She exhaled with shaky relief. Her muscles relaxed, and they never could when the little terror was around.